Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to part two of the first quarter wrap-up, News, Trends, and Stories with Dr. Joseph Farrell. We had a great discussion, mostly on the U.S. domestic side and an overview of our theme, the U.S. states' opportunity to lead financial freedom. So great discussion last week. We saw there's tremendous pushback, but the friction, of course, grows higher. And now we turn to the global game with stories 11 to 20. We're also going to do unanswered questions and inspiration. And we have a lot to talk about, including what just happened in Moscow and then in Baltimore. Tit for tat, question mark? Well, that's one of the big unanswered questions. So let's just dive in. Our first story, story number 11, is Mr. Global's many faces of control and genocide. And I think, you know, the hardest thing about facing what's going on is we are seeing an effort to centralize, which is not only asserting unbelievably invasive control using new digital technology and new weaponry, but we're also seeing mass slaughter on an unprecedented scale. And we've seen that before. I mean, World War I and World War II came with tremendous amounts of genocide, but we're seeing it again. And it starts, in fact, with what is happening, you know, what happened globally with COVID, but we're also watching Gaza and the Ukraine.
Oh, yes.
So let's just dive in. We talked a fair amount about COVID. I do want to mention it's coming up that you know, now that Trump has locked up the Republican nomination, it's coming up again that a lot of his supporters are disillusioned with him because he continues to support the vaccination, despite the incredible reports of, you know, yeah, of intentional harm. So, you know, as I said to somebody, I said to Greg Hunter about a year ago, it's like voting for Stalin for, you know. So I don't know how. I said to you last week that it was a little bit like watching a combination between the siege of Stalingrad and the Stepford Wives. But that is absolutely going to impact the election one way or the other. We have, it's March 30th, or it's the end of March now. We're on Easter weekend, and we have until November. So you have April, May, June, July, August, September, October. It's a long way to the election.
Yeah.
Do you think mass atrocity will impact the election at all?
I still expect them to pull something. I really do, between now and the election. I really do. But whether it's a mass atrocity or something like that, I don't know. We're certainly seeing a lot of that. But how it's going to affect things, I don't know.
Right.
What is interesting to me is that Trump appears to be running a very different kind of campaign than he did originally. And I'm not getting anywhere near the same sense of vision and agenda from him this time around as the last time.
Well, I think he's got 90 plus court actions, right, against him all around the country, including, yeah, indictments for criminal behavior. So I can't imagine having to field and manage 90 lawsuits all at the same time.
No, I can't
you
either.
You know, I did 18 audits, investigations, plus 12 tracks of litigation. That was pretty overwhelming. Yeah. So I think it's very hard. And of course, we just saw New York, well, they backed the bond down to a more manageable size. But basically, if you look, yeah, at the decision against him in New York, it's one of the most lawless things I've seen New York do. And
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Is having a competition among lawless things. So it's basically the government saying we can take your assets. And you, right, almost have a feeling that between the British royal family and Trump, they're marketing, you know, they're normalizing taking your assets and
yep,
turbo cancer.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's jump to Gaza, because I think Gaza, yeah, is something that has taken up a lot of focus in the first quarter. And it's to say that it's a remarkable event. I mean, it's basically the faction, the organized crime faction that controls Israel at this point is basically saying, we want the land, we want the oil and gas, we're taking it, and we're moving the population down to Egypt, and if Egypt won't take them, we'll kill them.
Yeah.
And I had one huge back and forth with one of my allies who said, well, what would you do, you know, if you couldn't get the hostages? They're in the tunnels. And I wrote back and I said, are you saying that an empire that is built, is famous for building underground bases and underground transportation systems and can slant drill miles, can't find a way to go into tunnels without taking down, you know, 80% of the housing in Gaza? Are you out of your mind?
Yeah, this is what bothers me about this whole thing from the beginning. The thing that has disturbed me the most, Catherine, is not only the scale of the barbarity of the initial attacks inside of Israel. What I've never heard satisfactorily answered is how one of the most heavily policed, technologically mined borders in the world was so easily breached by so-called Hamas terrorists. And I'm not saying they weren't terrorists. I'm not saying that they weren't Hamas. What I'm having difficulty with is how easily that operation breached that border.
Right. And the fact that the Israeli IDF just happened to confiscate all the long rifles all along that border right before.
Right before. Yeah.
The
whole thing's rotten. And it looks to me like, this is nothing but a false flag land grab op under the guise of terrorism.
Right.
You know, they pulled the same thing in this country on 9/11 to get their Patriot Act and everything else done, and to steal a lot of money too. This looks the same thing to me.
The challenge. First of all, this is not, you know, I could say this is Netanyahu and his organized crime syndicate, but this is the United States.
Yeah.
The United States is financing this. The United States is supplying a lot of the arms. So the U.S. has decided. So we have the U.S. government engaged in a mass atrocity against its own citizens. We have the people who run Israel engaged in a mass atrocity against their citizens. Now the U.S. government and the group that runs Israel is engaged in a mass atrocity against the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And what we have to understand is we're all financing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is, to me, it's unconscionable, the bloodletting that has happened around all of us.
Here's the problem.
For this indiscriminate killing. There just isn't.
Well, here's the excuse. Jared Kushner praises very valuable potential of Gaza's waterfront properties. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that's what it's about.
The Palestinians must die so that Jared and his family can be wealthy.
I'm sorry. I'm not buying.
I mean, I think this is pretty simple because if you look at the insider trading on the Tel Aviv and the Israeli stocks on October 2nd, there's no way that Mossad was surprised.
No,
it's impossible.
Totally. That's my point about the technologically mined border. There is no way that the Mossad at least did not know this was coming. I'm sorry. I'm not buying it for a minute.
So we looked at South Africa's complaint against Israel in the, mm-hmm. you know, at The Hague. And I dare say that this is turning the world against Israel and the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can't. The United States has enough going against it already. I mean, I would not, if I were an ally of the United States, I wouldn't trust us as far as we can throw us. And I'm saying that largely because of the way we've handled the Ukraine. as far as I can tell, the only purpose of this war right now and us propping it up is to kill as many Ukrainians as possible. This is a country that we've used as a cat's paw to fight Russia, and we've basically depopulated it. They have lost significant segments of their population.
So if you look at the presidential election, we have three candidates, and they all support Israel and Gaza.
Yeah.
So we have a complete, you know, Israel has a, or I shouldn't say Israel, Netanyahu and his faction, but war in the Middle East has the complete support of all three candidates. If you look at the Ukraine, there's disagreement. So Kennedy is very much for pulling out of Ukraine. The current administration is obviously for staying in. I have not seen what Trump has said recently on Ukraine. But my guess is Trump is also going to veer towards standing down in the Ukraine. It's clear that the current administration wants to, I mean, if you look at all the noise to expand the war using NATO, it's very significant.
It's very significant. And again, I think it's part of the criminality of the whole Biden regime that is dictating policy there. Because, you know,
here's what I don't understand. So you've moved 8 to 10 million Ukrainians to Europe or Russia, and you've killed anywhere from 300,000 to 500,000 Ukrainian soldiers. Easily. Okay, so you've cleaned out the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, what's the plan? You have Macron leading the way to argue for European soldiers to go in, and lots of noise to indicate that the U.S. is ready to send, you know, people, soldiers through NATO. Mm-hmm. NATO can't possibly win a land war in the Ukraine.
No. Catherine, I am totally, totally mystified as to why there is this push to get NATO ground troops involved for several reasons, not the least of which is that there are simply not enough NATO troops to be militarily significant, operationally significant against the current Russian ground forces in the theater. That's number one. Number two, the manufacturing and industrial base that NATO would need to fight the Russians has been gutted. And that, let's be honest, that industrial base was Germany.
Well, is pushing for the oil and gas in Gaza and getting it from the Mediterranean up to Germany part of what they need to engage in a war?
Well, maybe so, but the problem is NATO, what I'm getting at is the industrial base is not there because of the stupid policies of the German government vis-a-vis the oil and manufacturing, which is leaving Germany. So you cannot fight the kind of war in the Ukraine that NATO wants to fight against Russia and not have a manufacturing base. We do not have enough logistical support, Catherine, to supply enough 155 millimeter artillery shells to the Ukrainian army as it is. And our ability to supply just that one item of ammunition, which the Russians are capable of supplying to their forces easily. So what I'm getting at is NATO is not in any position to wage the kind of war that they want to wage. So the next question I have that I can't make sense of is, are they really pushing for a nuclear war with Russia? And if so, why? That makes no sense to me either.
Well, the question is, what is just promoting narrative? I mean, here's the thing.
That could be.
If you can't get your populations to go on along with the official narrative anymore and you're losing control and you can't get the control grid implemented, right, why not have a war and why not have a draft?
Well, you could do that. Yeah, you can do all of that. Just... you can create a war for the purposes of controlling your own population.
Right.
But that's a rather hazardous proposition when you're fighting a country like Russia. This is my problem. Because you're getting involved in a war that you cannot win, and that means that eventually whatever opposition you face internally might hook up with the Russians. You know, this whole thing is nutty to me. And the idea of France, yeah, France is a nuclear power, true. They could do some severe damage to Russia if it came to that, true. But the idea that they're going to survive a war with Russia, no, that's not going to happen. So Catherine, the only thing that I can think of is I agree with you, and I've tended to this view myself, is that this is being done for domestic reasons rather than for genuine foreign policy interests. The Western political class is losing the narrative battle, and it's losing, as we've seen with the farmers, which I know that we're going to talk about.
Right.
They're losing significant swaths of their own populations. It looks to me like this is more about internal control than any real objective or concern about the Ukraine or Russian intentions or what have you.
Well, but here's the problem. Is Russia going to stop where they are? Are they going to keep moving into the Ukraine?
No. We might as well talk about the Moscow attacks in this regard. I have not yet had time to blog about it, nor about the Baltimore bridge thing. But, Catherine, the way it looks to me is I do think the ISIS organization that has claimed responsibility, I do think it was involved. But the problem I'm having, and I'm agreeing with the Russian leadership's assessment here, ISIS, number one, has all these dubious connections to American intelligence. I mean, that's
right.
Been fairly reasonably clear. Number two, the people that the Russians apprehended, the alleged suspects of this thing, are not behaving to me like any standard ISIS terrorist. A standard terrorist act is those people that commit it are supposed to commit suicide when it gets to that point, not get in a car and drive to the border of the Ukraine. You know, this is my big problem with the terrorist narrative. So in other words, this to me looks like, yeah, ISIS may be involved, but that's the surface level. I don't think this operation could have been planned, financed, or organized without some major Western power backing it. And the cutout, once again, I think was probably the Ukraine. What clues me in here is Bortnov, the guy that is the head of the Russian FSB, Federalnaya Slyuzhba Bezopasnosti, has come out basically and said that they are examining the possibility of Western involvement. I will not be a bit surprised that the Russians are going to make this a very thorough investigation and that they're going to publish the results of their investigation, with the exception of the people they think were involved and organized. I think they're going to, what Bortnov is saying, I think the gloves have just come off. I've been, as you know, warning about this for years, that if they start targeting Russian leadership and Russian installations, the Russians will respond in kind.
Right.
So I think the gloves just came off. I really do. Don't be surprised if all of a sudden you hear about Ketchup Carry or Der Hochklaus von Bloschwab und Bloviation having drones dropped on them. Don't be surprised if you start hearing in the news. This is now a mafia war, and the mafia dons are at war with each other. That's what's happening.
So, obviously, we have a bridge come down in Baltimore under highly suspicious circumstances.
Yes.
And and it just happens to be the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Key Bridge.
Who wrote the National Anthem.
National Anthem. Yes.
And we know that there's a Dolly painting in St. Petersburg called...
Yes.
Yeah.
The Bridge.
The Bridge, the Bridge and the Dream. The Bridge and the Dream, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's becoming... The more that comes out about what happened... the more it becomes impossible to fathom that it was an accident. I mean, it's looking more and more like this was no accident.
No, Catherine, I'm glad you're talking about this, because when I heard about the bridge and then I literally was awake when it happened. So I'm listening to the radio as I'm reading my book in bed, and I'm listening to this, and bang, the FBI comes out and says, we have no reason to suspect that this was anything other than an accident, and we have no reason to suspect it was terrorism, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the first thing I remember thinking was, okay, the FBI is already doubling down that this was just an unfortunate accident, so that means it's probably not an accident. And they
we've had subscribers who've worked in the, you know,
right,
have worked in ports and worked with marine operations in port,
precisely,
and are saying, you know, this story makes no sense if you look at the procedures, everything else. Yeah.
It makes no sense because you're going to have a harbor pilot on board that ship getting it out of the harbor, number one. Number two, the ship is going to have backup steering mechanisms. A container ship like that will have backup systems. That's number two. Number three, the way I look at the video, Catherine, I watched this thing the morning after it happened, and I'm just watching aghast and in disbelief, because the power goes out and then back on three different times. So clearly you have a crew that's trying to get control of a situation that they've lost control of. You see the diesels, puffs of smoke coming from the restart of the diesel engines, and it looks like it's all going fine. And then, bang, at the last minute, it turns and heads directly for the pylon. And I'm thinking, Catherine, as I'm watching all of this, this is deliberate, and I'll tell you why. Remember the USS John McCain incident in the Black Sea?
Yep.
When the Russian fighter shut down all the electronics on board.
Right.
That's incident number one. Then we had the USS Fitzgerald incident in the Sea of Japan, with a U.S. Navy vessel being literally rammed by a cargo ship, which veers into it, and which apparently the crew may have lost control of. Then we had the USS John McCain incident off the Straits of Malacca, near Singapore, a few months later after that. And the Navy's trying to tell us this is all because of bad training and so on, which it may have been. But I'm thinking, no, this can't be happening with this kind of frequency without some sort of deliberate action. And the thing that convinces me above all about the Baltimore thing is not only have we seen demonstrations of a technological capability by the Russians.
Right.
By the Russians. We have also, in the case of the Francis Scott Key incident, the bridge, there are, I think, two or three sea lift vessels now that are stuck in the harbor of Baltimore until they can get the channel opened up. And that's why I think the military reacted so quickly and sent the Corps of Engineers in there to get that channel cleared, because those sea lifts ships are what we use to move soldiers by sea and their supplies by sea to deployments in overseas locations. So we've got three of these ships bottled up. Tell me that that's not somebody sending us a message, especially with a Ukrainian captain.
So, and if I understand it correctly, is that ship not owned by the company that was run by Mitch McConnell's
sister-in-law
who was just killed?
Who was just killed. I think two weeks before the incident. So, yeah, when you total all this together, it's too, the timing of it, the way that the actual collision with the bridge occurred, the fact that we have military sea lift capability bottled up in the harbor, the fact that we have the FBI assuring us that there's no reason to suspect terrorism or anything like that. You know, this government is now unable even to have its lies believed. The first thing I thought was, oh, the FBI is saying no accident, then yeah, it's probably the opposite of what they're saying. So what I would say is
it feels to me, whoever did this, because remember, it doesn't necessarily have to be a nation state that did
right.
this.
Right. I agree.
Right. So, but it says, you know, what it says is we can decimate your infrastructure and economy whenever we want.
Whenever we want. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, if it's a non-state actor, I'm willing to go with my good old friends, the Nazi International. I really am. Because what the goal of these people appears to be is a kind of global fascism. And right. So I don't rule that kind of action in this case out of the picture. However, we have also been served up warnings repeatedly in history and in recent history by the Russian government that if you keep doing this, we're going to respond in kind. So I do hold open the possibility that maybe this is already the hot war between the mafia dons, and this is stage one of that sort of retaliation.
If Moscow thought the Moscow killing, the mass shooting, was CIA or US financed and backed, then then it's perfectly plausible this could have been the Russians.
Well, it's perfectly plausible. And there's another reason why, Catherine, and that's all of the attempted NATO attacks on the Kerch bridge over the Kerch Straits between the Caucasus right. and the right. Crimean Peninsula.
Right.
In that case, you have, I think the Russians have made a plausible enough prima facie case that there was Western involvement in those attacks. So this could be a response, not necessarily to the Moscow attacks, but in fact to something earlier, is what I'm getting at. So I, at this point, Catherine, the bottom line is, I think we're probably both agreed. I don't think that the Baltimore Bridge incident was accidental at all. It is amazing to me how quickly the internet has demolished any possibility of that interpretation holding any water. So right. I'm holding open the possibility that it's a non-state actor like you, or I'm holding open the possibility that it's a Russian horizontal escalation response in response to something. But my guess is not so much the Moscow attacks, but that this might be the response for the Kerch Bridge
right.
attacks.
One of the things, one of our sections in this story is the biolabs and biodefense industry.
Yeah.
We are seeing an explosion of money. I mean, the U.S. has been pouring money into biodefense since 9/11.
Right.
But the new National Defense Authorization Act just poured money in. And of course, I'm getting reports from around the world of people being encouraged to invest in building vaccine manufacturers to deal with, you know, bioterrorist attacks by viruses. So, you know, this is not a pandemic. It's going to be a I call it Putin, you know, Putin 19 mm-hmm. or Putin 24, whatever you want to call it. But it's truly frightening because when you put this much money into these laboratories, they're all, you know, from people I know who are in the industry, they tell me leaks happen.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put this much money into biodefense labs around the world and leaks happen, you know, a lot could go wrong. One of the things I question is the concern over the Ukraine. The fact that the truth of whatever they've been doing with the biodefense labs, they're going to come out if the Russians take control.
Well, the Russians have already, in the initial stages of their military operation, we have to remember that the Russians did take over some of those biolab locations.
Right.
And they did publish some of the documentation that they recovered from some of those installations. What they did recover, if I remember correctly, they even had a lieutenant general give press conferences. He was the general that's in charge of the Russian military's biological warfare department. And this lieutenant general came out and just very bluntly stated that what they had found thus far indicated to them that they were dealing with a bioweapons program. He made a point to emphasize that this was based on what they had found in only two or three laboratories. Now, if you add all of the laboratories in the Ukraine to that, I suspect that you might have been looking at not just a bioweapons program to target Russians, but that you might have been looking at a comprehensive bioweapons program, not just targeting Russians, but their livestock, their plant food supply, and so on and so forth.
In other words, the Chinese, I think, too. If you look at the problems
the Chinese
have had with swine flu and other things,
absolutely.
Looks to me like bioterrorism.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we have to remember yet another thing about the West's program in the Ukraine, and that's the introduction of GMOs into the Ukraine.
Right.
And the fact that the Ukrainian government did all those deals with Monster Santo and other agribusiness companies to grant them port access and so on and so forth. So I think the West program in the Ukraine was a total one, and along came Putin and said, no, you don't.
So one of the big questions for the first quarter is, why did Victoria Nuland quit? Was she thrown out? Was she booted out? Is it true about the money laundering scandals that she's in trouble over investigation of the money laundering through the Ukraine? You know, is it possible that what they're planning on doing is even so evil that even she will not go along with it?
Well, that's, you know, I hate to say it, but that's a possibility, too. I personally lean to the idea that she was becoming too much of a liability. And so they decided to toss her under the bus.
So the liability is because of the election, or where does the liability come in? They've never worried about, her before.
I think the liability is that she's too much the face of American involvement in the Ukraine. And the other thing that I think you have to bear in mind if you weigh her as a liability is that she is the public face of Ukrainian policy. So to dismiss her creates a message, or the possible message, that the policy might be changed. So in other words, what I think you have to factor in here, Catherine, is if you want to confuse the Russian decision-making process vis-a-vis the Ukraine and vis-a-vis the West's posture in the Ukraine, what do you do? What do you do to create the impression that the policy might be changing soon? Well, drop the person that's most publicly identifiable with the West's policy in the Ukraine thus far. The other allegations and so on regarding her, they also may have decided, well, we need to drop her because those things are going on, so let's kill two, let's stack functions, as you like to say. Kill two birds with one stone and get rid of her.
Right.
What I think is interesting is that before she resigned, she apparently said that Putin, has to watch out. We're going to get him somehow. She gave out some sort of warning, and then bang, we had the Moscow attacks. So, and that was one thing that the head of the FSB, when he gave his press conference, actually mentioned, that they were looking at all of this. And one of the things that he gave as the reasons for the Russians considering that it was a Western-sponsored attack was precisely what she had said prior to that attack about 2 weeks before. So, you know, and apparently the other thing that they've come out with is that apparently some of the perpetrators involved in this incident were in Moscow a couple of weeks prior to the actual attack. And for whatever reason, they couldn't pull it off. And they're now thinking, the Russians are now thinking, that the attack was originally scheduled right in the middle of the Russian elections.
Really?
So, oh yeah, yeah. They think the Russians have advanced the idea that the attack, for whatever reason, may have had to be have been delayed. But back to Newland, I really think that we're looking at the potential that they decided to drop her because of the impending scandals, but also perhaps to create a false impression for the Russians. Now, if that was the case, Catherine, for the motivation for dropping her, at this stage, I think the Western leadership is indulging in wishful thinking. For the simple reason that at this stage, I think the Russians have completely given up on the idea of any serious open diplomatic channel or dialogue with the current Western leadership, and particularly with Biden, Joe, and Emmanuel Macron, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And
but
what's
I think,
really... Go ahead.
You know, if you watch Putin's interview with Tucker Carlson, I did not learn anything listening to that.
All I heard
was Putin do a relatively good job of describing what I already knew.
Right.
And I think the Russians have decided that there is no point in negotiating with the insane.
I agree. That's exactly what I'm saying.
They are having the same reaction that many Americans are having, which is
right.
These people are insane.
Right.
There's no point in dealing with them. This right. comes down to force.
Yes.
Can they force? You know, can we refuse? And it's that simple. There's no point in talking with them anymore. They're not rational humans.
I agree with that, and I'm going to add to it, because if you examine the statements of Mr. Bortnikoff, or I can never remember what his surname is, but the head of the FSB. If you look at his statements very carefully, he seems to be implying what I've been trying to warn people about for a long time, namely that as long as we're going to try and target Russian leadership and leadership infrastructure and so on and so forth, they will eventually respond in kind. And I think when Bortnikoff gave that press conference and laid out what they were investigating, I think that was the message that we've just taken the gloves off. So in other words, Mr. Zelensky, if you want to drop drones on us, we're going to do the same for you and all of your accomplices. Mr. Macron, Mr. Bloschwab, all of these people are now on the list as far as I'm concerned. We're gonna start seeing attacks on the leadership of the West. And in addition to that, attacks on the command and control infrastructure that they rely on. There's no doubt in my mind that this is what we're going to see.
So here's the question. If you were running Russia today or China uh-huh. today, what would you do?
Good question. But I think the first thing I would do is I would look to the national interest first, as both countries are doing. I would continue to expand and tighten our financial relationships bilaterally with each other, and also bilaterally with all the member nations in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which they're doing. But in addition to that, especially if I were Russia, Xi's in a different position, and he has to be much more careful. But Mr. Putin, I think, has and his leadership team have concluded that for Russia, it is clear that this is an existential crisis. In other words, I think that their assessment is that the Western leadership is so insane that they intend to break up the current Russian state and do a real rape of Russia. So right. I think for them, if I were Mr. Putin, I would tell the FSB to track down all human intelligence cells or suspected cells inside of the Russian Federation, number one. Number two, I would send out the Spetsnaz teams and activate the sleeper cells that are, you know, still there in Western Europe and the United States and Canada. And I'd say, go for it. Take them out. Take out Hunter Biden. Take out Joe Biden. And anybody else supporting these insane policies of warfare against this country. I absolutely would. We've got to remember that the Russian cultural experience is Byzantine.
Well, here's the interesting thing. So we, John Titus just made a new video about Secretary Yellen. So Treasury Secretary Yellen just made a statement that she believed there was a way to basically seize and use all the Russian assets to finance the Ukraine.
Right.
And basically she was saying, you know, we believe if we just take it and spend it on the Ukraine, we ought to be able to come up with some justification. So what she's proposing is basically stealing the Russians' money.
Stealing the Russians' money to fund a war against Russia. Right.
Right. And there's no way that you, that I know of, that you can make that work under the law.
You can't make that work under the law.
Right.
But if I were Mr. Putin, I would, again, you asked me what I would do. And if I were Mr. Putin, I'd order every legal means to prevent that from happening. And I would also order every study to be done of any counter suit. That you want lawfare, so start lawfare against all these institutions in the West. But I would not hesitate, if she wants that, put her on the hit list. And the reason I'm saying this, and people have to understand this, if they don't, they're not going to get Russia. Russia comes out of a Byzantine culture.
Right.
The Byzantine Empire was well known. I mean, it's not called Byzantine for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The Byzantine Empire was well known. If they could prevent a war with a carefully timed and well-placed assassination, Christian empire that they were, that's what they would do.
Right. And that's the other guys who would do it is the Venetians. That's a very Venetian thing to do.
The other guys, and who are the Venetians tied to? Byzantium.
Right.
So in other words, this is part of their culture. This is part of the way they think. It is more Christian to do that than have a full-blown war, is what I'm saying.
Right.
And if these Western leaders think they can keep poking the bear in this way and not expect some sort of consequence, I'm sorry. You know, there's a famous movie called The Sum of All Fears with Ben Affleck, and it's based on a Tom Clancy novel.
Right.
Well, you know, they've got this Nazi guy, which I think is interesting that they changed the plot in the movie from Arab terrorists to Nazis. But this guy is trying to plot a nuclear war, get a nuclear war started between Russia and the United States, and the Russians find out that it's a Nazi, so they plant a car bomb in his car. And, you know, he goes to escape and drive away into the sunset in his car and presses the cigarette lighter to light a cigarette, thinking he's managed to escape and kablooey, you know. So yeah, I really think the Western leadership is playing with fire here.
So here's the thing. If we have entered a period of asymmetrical warfare, and I think we entered it 20 years ago, but now it's accelerating.
I agree with you, yes.
So if you look at the Baltimore Bridge, you know, I give that a very high chance. I'm with you, a very high chance of being an act of war.
Right.
But if you look at how fragile the United States infrastructure is and how susceptible to this kind of warfare. And remember, I believe a lot of the American leadership wants to see the country break up. And this kind of warfare will help get them there, right?
Right, right.
So I think between the possibility of a continued rise in all-cause mortality and a continued rise of asymmetrical warfare, we are in for a phenomenally high-friction period. I mean, we're not in for it. We're in it. We're in it.
We're in it now, but it's going to get much much hotter, I think.
Right.
The problem as I see it, Catherine, and I don't know if you're seeing the same types of problems here, but this is not a good time to try and be introducing central bank digital currency. Because,
well, except they need control.
They need control, but the problem is you're also trying to do this as you're entering this period of hot warfare, and you're dealing with countries, namely Russia and China, that have whole departments of their intelligence apparatus dedicated to cyber warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, central bank digital currency is fine unless the enemy turns off the power.
Right.
You know,
or the electricians. Remember, the electricians.
Or the electricians.
The French central bank.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, this is, they're trying all these kooky schemes at the very time that the schemes, which are fragile to begin with, can so easily be scuttled, or for that matter, hijacked. You know, talk about nightmare scenario. So, you know, again, if I were Putin or Xi right now, and even more so if I were Xi, I'd be beefing up the counterintelligence and intelligence covert operations bureaus and sending in the sleeper teams, which, of course, I think they're doing at the border now anyway. So,
I think it's the American leadership who's financing the terrorists coming across. They're the ones who need them.
Well, the American, but look, again, let's get out of the one size fits all model. The border is being used by the American leadership to infiltrate terrorists into the country in a population replacement scheme and so on and so forth. Yes.
Right.
That's faction one. China and Russia are probably infiltrating sleeper teams into the same border at the same time. That's faction two. Then we have faction number three, the non-state fascist actors in the world. That's faction three. So in other words, again, I think all of this is happening. It's not a one-size-fits-all scenario.
Let me just float one idea to you. So we see announcements that the Chinese are being allowed to set up police stations all around the United States to police PRC citizens. You know, a couple of years ago in Zurich, saw a new conductor, Chinese, it looked like Chinese military, as a Swiss conductor. I'd never seen a conductor on a Swiss train that wasn't Swiss. And he was nasty and yelling at the Swiss, and they were scared. It was frightening to see in the middle of Zurich. And we just had a report that police, Chinese, are operating as police in Hungary. And, you know, my question is, Mr. Global planning on using the Chinese to be the global cops?
Maybe. Again, it's a crazy scheme that they would certainly use. They're crazy enough to try it, but again, like all their crazy schemes, ultimately it's not going to work.
Right.
you know, right. Sooner or later, those Chinese cops are going to encounter some good old-fashioned vigilante justice from fed-up Hungarians or whoever they're trying to police.
Unless Mr. Bloomberg succeeds in pulling in all the guns.
Oh, I don't think he will.
Yeah, I don't think he will either, but you just wouldn't believe. You would not believe how much time that one individual wastes of legislators' time and energy.
Oh, I would believe it.
One of the reasons it's hard to get anything done at the legislature is so much of their time is wasted by people trying to centralize control.
Yeah. It's
unbelievable. Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to story number 12. Farmers push back loud and long. Mm-hmm. So we just published, and we'll send it to the printer shortly. It'll be out hopefully by the end of April. Else von Hamelin did a piece on the Dutch farmers and fishermen that is absolutely extraordinary. And it's part, you know, first we did pharma food to show how frightening they are, you know, their fake food that they're planning. But then one of the things, you know, in the Netherlands society, the farmers are highly respected and are very integrated part of the population. They live everywhere. You know, you go to a party and you know, there are farmers there and fishermen. So, it's a much more extroverted community in the Netherlands than it is, and in Europe than it is in the United States. It's a much more sort of, you know, we're all in Kansas and we've got these big ag subsidies and, you know, we market wholesale and we're not integrated into the community the way they are in Europe. Anyway, when it first started, and the sort of the efforts to steal the land from the farmers or move them off the land or bring on some of the climate change rules and regulations, the farmers first started off assuming that the government was legit, that they were really trying to do something to protect the environment. And it took many, many years to realize, oh, we're sane, they're insane, and they are using all of this just to steal our stuff and kill us.
Right.
And it took, anyway, one of our goals when we realized that it was hard for people to see the whole, you know, the farmers as a piece of the control game and see how they fit into the control game, we decided to do this series of interviews with farmers and fishermen and then write up this wrap up. And, you know, this was a project that took almost a year. It was a huge project. And Elsa did an incredible job, as she always does. But you read it and you see where it all fits together. And what you've seen in the European Union, which is so exciting, is the farmers finally are beginning to see the whole, you know, they see the whole picture whole and picture, they realize, yeah. Oh, you know, we're the sane, they're the insane. They want to steal our land, kill us, you know, and they're nice versions and mean versions. But basically, they want to shut us down, and they want to either starve the population or feed them synthetic meat.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at this, and they're saying, these people are nuts, and we're not going to let them. And here's the you know, I don't know the German or French or Polish farmers the way, you know, I've gotten a feel for the Dutch farmers. But these are very intelligent, very competent, very good people and very capable of organizing. And if you look at the organization of what the farmers have done, it is amazing. These guys are really, really good, and they cooperate. They work together. They know how to get things done. And you know something? They are shaking up the leadership in Europe.
Good.
And yeah, it's great. But the other thing is now they know, you know, now they know you're up against the insane. And what that means is they've become a much more effective force. If I was the leadership, I would be scared.
Well, they should be scared.
They should be scared.
Because, you know, like I say, I really see only two ways that this ends. Either they're at the end of a rope or we are. That's
so
the only two ways this ends.
I don't agree, and I'll tell you why. I watched a TED Talk in the first quarter that really struck me, and I've talked a lot about it, so forgive me for repeating this, but it was a scholar who went back and studied revolutions for the last couple hundred years and came back and said, the most effective revolutions are civil disobedience, not violence. And the reason
No, Catherine, I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about justice.
Ah, okay. So
No, I'm not talking about violence. I think the only way that this successfully ends is if the people that have been responsible for all of this insanity are held responsible and face due process.
Right, right.
That's what I mean.
Ah, okay. Okay, so what was interesting about this research that I was telling you about is, and they came to the conclusion that it only took 3.5% of the population to engineer a successful civil disobedience revolution. And if you look at the idea of those leading that revolution using financial, you know, just as they've weaponized finance against us, we can reverse that.
Yes.
And we can say, okay, we're not financing you anymore. Yeah. If you're going to take our money and use it to kill us and poison our children, we're not going to finance you anymore.
Yeah.
So
this is why I was saying earlier that if I were Mr. Putin, I'd open the lawfare floodgates against these people.
Well, if you were Mr. Putin, how would you open the lawfare floodgates in a way that the local populations could lead that lawfare?
Well, that's an interesting question. I hadn't considered that, but it could happen. In other words, if he found a way to basically hide or launder money or financial support to groups like that that are outside of Russia, what I had in mind was just, you know, start a bunch of lawsuits and hire a bunch of law firms. But what you're talking about is something different. Could the Russians do it? Well, yeah, if they put their mind to it.
Well, here's the other thing the Russians could do. Because I have a lot of respect for Russian intelligence.
I do too.
And the Russian scientific establishment. So what the Russians could do, so if you listen to Putin when he talked to Tucker Carlson, he said there's no point in trying to play the media game up against, you know, the Western empires, because they're right. So, you know, the whole thing is so controlled, mind controlled. So there's no point in playing that game.
Right.
But what they could do is they could constantly leak documents to, you know, yes. So you've got people pushing back all around the world. You've got yes. attorney generals. You've got treasurers. You've got people bringing litigation, Health Freedom Fund. You've got Children's Health Defense. You know, you could continue to leak documents to people like Matt Taibbi and all sorts of folks, and the documents speak for themselves, and the documents give you standing in court.
This is exactly, I think, one of the things that the Russians are thinking about when people like Medvedev are talking about horizontal escalation. In other words, we have a lot of information that we can leak, and that can be part of the soft warfare. This is exactly the type of thing that I think they are capable of doing, and I think it's something that probably they are considering doing. Yeah, this
may be one of the reasons that the yes. Biden administration is trying to go so hard to complete control.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And again, if I were the Bidens, I'd be extremely worried about the possibility of those kinds of leaks from Russia. Absolutely.
Well, here's the thing. It's very hard to imagine that Biden makes it to the election.
I've heard that too.
I don't think Biden's running anything. I assume Obama's running the White House, but I don't see how Biden makes it to the election. I mean, it's possible he makes it to the election, but even if he does, if he's the Democratic candidate, it's going to take a lot of election rigging to assume that Biden wins. And of course, if you look at who Kennedy just chose as his vice president candidate, it wouldn't surprise me if Kennedy took California.
And it wouldn't surprise me either. No.
Right. So that's clear. If Kennedy can get on the ballot and stays in and takes California, then it's a clear road in for Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yep. Yep.
It is.
Yep. So, so back to the farmers. I really wonder if it is possible for the farmers in Europe, because, you know, they got the EU to back off on some of the Net Zero Alliance issues. I'm wondering if they can literally stop the digital ID and CBDC. The farmers, you know, particularly if you add the plumbers and the electricians, have you ever tried to run a central bank without a toilet? No, really, I'm serious. You know, the yellow jackets have a lot more power than everybody realizes.
No, I haven't thought of it in quite those terms, but yeah. Well, look, if those European farmers are as awake as you say, then they've probably already figured out that the central bank digital currency cashless technocratic society is all part of the same operation.
Right, right.
And if they figure that out,
whatever has been stolen now, as soon as that clicks into place, they steal everything.
They steal everything. Yeah. So,
I'm always having these wonderful fights with the health freedom movement. And I said, what's the point of fighting against mandates? If they get CBDC and digital ID, they'll just be back. So why don't you help me fight CBDC and digital IDs?
Well, the thing that heartens me about the European farmers is the fact that the British farmers finally joined them.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, amazing.
I was shocked when the German farmers did, but the real shock came when the Brits joined in. That means the EU technocrats are in very bad shape. Now, I'll be even happier when certain people, in addition to French government buildings being sprayed with manure, I will be even happier when they figure out who's, you know, some of the people that they need to be targeting for similar treatment. That's all I'll say. I'm not doxing. I'm just mentioning it as a general principle.
Okay. Okay. So story 13, the who coup, would who fake ratification? So Merrill Mass started Door to Freedom and has done an absolutely fantastic job working with the Sovereignty Coalition to try and stop the WHO treaty from clicking into place. And they've worked in Washington. They've worked in countries around the world. It's amazing how many countries have said to them, oh, you know, but if we don't go along with this, the bankers will shut off our credit. So it's clear that credit and trade controls are very much, you know, behind it and, you know, enforcing everybody into these horrible international agreements. But, of course, we mentioned it last week, but the Louisiana Senate just unanimously passed a bill that denies any communication from the WHO, UN, and WEF as a basis for action within the state. So that means literally everybody in the state says, no, I'm not doing that. Now, the problem is the WHO's going to work through federal offices. Mm-hmm. So, that's going to bring, we're going to get back to the states' rights issue. It appears, as they've gone through the history of the WHO, that a lot of the times that WHO says it has ratification or agreements to the treaty, it's just lying. It just it just says it has the authority when it doesn't.
Right.
And we had a very important breakthrough, and that was a mainstream Belarus TV ran a 7-minute segment basically calling out the whole WHO scam. And that was the first breakthrough into mainstream TV. Or I should say corporate TV. So I want to do a big shout out to Belarus because that was pretty fabulous.
Всемирная организация здравоохранения активно готовится ко всепланетарному буйству болезни X. Вирус где-то незримо, но неумолимо зреет, намереваясь начать свою убийственную жатву. Единственный способ для человечества выжить – это, конечно, молиться, но не богам, а ВОЗ. «Приди же, Тедрос Гебрейесус, владей нами, ну спаси». Приблизительно такова логика авторов пресловутого пандемического соглашения, о котором, надо полагать, многие даже не слышали. А оно, между тем, обещает радикальнейшим образом переменить жизнь землян, причем всех и каждого. Слово Олегу Романову.
Что такое эта болезнь X, не знает никто. Тем не менее, нам обещают, что она будет в 20 раз смертоноснее коронавируса. Не спрашивайте, как удалось оценить опасность того, что еще не существует. У эпидемиологов, похоже, есть способы. Кофейная гуща, бросание башмачка за окно. Или вот, например, уже практически доказано, что ковид был создан искусственно, и деньги на него выделял доктор Фаучи, главный американский эпидемиолог. Вопреки американским законам, в лабораториях велась работа над gain of function – усилением функций. Сначала об этом писали газеты, а потом появились финансовые документы, которые подтверждали выделение грантов на селекцию опасных коронавирусов. Согласитесь, если с болезнью X дела обстоят так же, то в оценке ее смертности, понятное дело, ошибиться сложно. Но у любого вируса есть одно свойство, которое в данной ситуации является несомненным благом. Он неподкупен и одинаково страшен как для нищеброда, так и для миллиардера. Патоген же избирательного действия, от которого защищает толстый кошелек, пока, к счастью, не создан. Это, похоже, наша единственная защита. Правда, защита только жизни, а не свободы. Во спасение от болезни X в мае представителям всех стран планеты предлагают подписать так называемое пандемическое соглашение. И отказы не принимаются.
Well, you know, you're mentioning a principle, I think, here that let's generalize what you've just said. Because I think there are a lot of things that have been snuck through that never had ratification, proper ratification.
Right.
So would the WHO be capable of claiming ratification when there was none? Absolutely. But once you get a hold of the idea, well, let's just claim it was ratified and ram it down people's throats that way. Start looking at a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to say. But the numbers 13 and 16 come to mind.
And the U.S. income tax, right?
I was referring to. But 13 is important, too.
We just had Jackie DeVoe came out with a new documentary describing the euthanasia in the U.K. And, now that we have a realization that the WHO is, you know, providing air cover for euthanasia, mm-hmm. you know, I think it helps sort of shift the game.
Yes.
Okay. Story number 14, global elections. We have 74% of the global population participating in elections this year. It's quite astonishing. And to me, despite all the election rigging and, you know, digital shenanigans, I just see this as an opportunity for incredible pushback all around the world.
Oh, I think it's going to happen.
India is going to hold the largest election ever in the history of the world. It's going to be seven stages from April on. It's going to be very interesting. But I don't know what to say about the U.S. elections. I think the federal spending mechanism is so completely out of control. The question is, are any of the candidates going to try and do something to move the federal government back into a lawful, you know, are they capable and willing to take the U.S. operations and move them back into?
Well, I think there's two questions there, Catherine. Number one, are any of them willing to do that? And number two, even if they were, are they able to do so? And question number one is, I don't see any of the big three. I don't see Bobby Kennedy or Biden Joe or Donald Trump being at all willing to look into all of that. I just don't. But even
I'm sure Kennedy has looked into it because I've written and published things for him. So I did a Salieri paper on the number one. Salieri paper number one was on the federal credit and what were the issues that needed to be dealt with at the federal government. And if you look at all the people who've been advising him on economics, some of whom I've been going back and forth, well, I think there is a group around Kennedy that clearly understands the issues. So
okay.
Now, so what is politically feasible? If Kennedy were to win, what is politically feasible to do depends a tremendous amount on the population and what they're willing to support.
Well, this is the second part of the question. Even if they were able to or willing to do it, would they be able to do so? And I go back to, you know, what we said last week, that you wouldn't ever run for president without, you know, 2,000 licenses to kill.
No, at this point.
Or something.
When I said that, that was a while ago. So now I want an open-ended amount, and I want a committee. I want a committee that will run the process for me so that we have, you know, we have a process that is intelligent and dispassionate, right? So I would want a committee, and I want an open-ended amount. I'll just be blunt.
Yeah, well, you're making my point. In other words, even if Bobby Kennedy were to get into office and be willing to look at the federal budgetary process and try to do something about it, would he have enough boots on the ground, enough muscle inside the swamp to do that? And I'm not seeing it. He may have lots of good advisors, but I just don't see, you know, he strikes me in the same position as Trump was during his first administration. He's got all these wonderful ideas, but he's got no network and no soldiers, and he doesn't look like he's going to go into the DOJ and clean house that needs to be cleaned. That's where he start to clean the algae and stables.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I'm not seeing it.
Right.
I think the action in American politics from this point on, the federal government is a write-off. The federal government is now the Roman Empire.
So I'm gonna push back on this for a second.
Okay.
I agree that the federal government has failed. And whether or not it's fixable, I don't know. But
I don't think
a kinder, slower failure is gonna be better than a big bang failure.
Oh, I agree with
so,
that. Absolutely.
So I think it matters who's going to be the president next time.
Oh, I do
so
too.
I think a Kennedy administration will be very different than a Trump administration, because I'm convinced that the Trump administration, you know, it's going to be Jared Kushner, and it's going to be a rape. And I know what a rape looks like. I've seen it all around the world. I know what it looks like.
So you're hoping more for a Kennedy administration than a Trump administration.
I would prefer. Well, here's the thing. I'm not going to endorse any candidate yet.
I understand.
I don't know if I'm going to endorse any candidate, but a Kennedy administration is going to be, you know, Kennedy said it best. He said, "I'm a fix it populist and Trump is a break it populist." And and I would much rather have a fix it populist than a break it populist at this point. So I think the two look very different. I also think, you know, the question is, do the people who populate the top 1,000 positions care about America and love America, or do they hate Americans? And I think that makes a huge difference, not just in policies and money, but in the energetics of what happens.
Well, the problem I have is I'm not seeing Kennedy as a fix-it populist. He can say that, but everything that he seems to say to me is that he wants to break the Second Amendment almost as much as Bloomberg does. I think the real action in American politics from this time, from henceforth, is going to be at the state level and perhaps regional level. In other words, once the states start making these compact arrangements, you're going to see a type of de facto regional type of arrangement come into existence.
So let me just say one thing, because Kennedy came out very strongly on the Second Amendment, pro-Second Amendment. What he did do is he got a lot of pushback on it, and then he said if Congress voted against it, if Congress voted to overturn the Second Amendment, he would sign it, which to me was a terrible mistake, because Congress can't vote to overrule the Constitution in that way. And right. If the president signs it, you're going along with something that's flagrantly anti-constitutional. And to me, he put a huge target on his back.
Yeah,
but
I think he did.
His first statement was very strong.
I remember that.
And it was very good. He said, look, Switzerland, everybody has a gun in Switzerland. They have no mass shootings. The problem's not guns.
Right.
It was very good. It was very strong.
Well, that to me just kind of indicates that he's not strong in his convictions. I have misgivings about the man. But then again, they're not anywhere near as profound as my misgivings about Biden Joe, or for that matter, Orange Man Bad. But I really
think... Well, here's the question. Who will mandate a vaccine in the next biodefense game?
Well, the one that's least likely to, we already know that's Bobby Kennedy.
Right. Who's the least likely to put NATO into Ukraine and start a nuclear war?
That I don't know. I'd say that's probably a toss-up between Trump and Kennedy.
Yeah, that's what I think. So I think, I think if you look at willingness to go to war, it's very important to stop. Well, I don't even know who the candidate is going to be. Could it possibly be Hillary Clinton again?
My problem, we had this discussion between last week and this week. My problem is that I don't think the Democrats have a deep enough bench right now in terms of presidential politics. The only person of national stature that has half a brain in the entire Democratic Party at that level, I think, is probably Chuck Schumer.
I don't think Chuck Schumer could get elected dog catcher.
I don't think he could either. I'm not saying that he could get elected. I'm saying who has the stature and who has a recognizable name that they could possibly run. They can't run Hillary. Her brand is too tarnished. She might operate behind the scenes. I think she is right now, as much as Obama is. But they don't. Gavin Newsom is a disaster and an airhead on top of everything. No one likes Kamala Harris, or as I like to call her, the Ayatollah Kamala. But, this is the problem. They don't have anybody. There's all these talks on talk radio about, they're going to run Michelle Obama. Well, the problem is I don't think Michelle Obama wants to get anywhere near politics, number one.
Right.
And number two, there's all of this nonsense out there in the alternative right community that Michelle Obama is a transvestite or transgender or something. I don't know. So it's kind of a crazy situation. I can think back 20 years ago that the Democrats had a much deeper bench than they do now, and they can't even field a complete team right now. That's what I think is very odd about all this.
Right.
But you look at the other candidates, Kennedy and Trump, well, they don't have a very deep bench either. It's very peculiar that the national politics is kind of drying out. I think the action is going to be in the states for at least the next 30 years.
So I think you have a tremendous number of people who could be on the bench who don't want to be on the bench. It was very funny because I was in Washington to go to this one museum last Wednesday.
Yeah.
And we left Westchester at 7 a.m. and we arrived in Washington at 10 a.m. And I left Washington at 12:30 and I could not wait to get out of there.
Oh, it's oppressive. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's just the worst feeling. And I thought, what is this? Is this the field? Is this the electronics?
It's the field.
Oh, my God.
Catherine, in the early 90s, I've got to tell you, since you mentioned this, I was looking for a particular piece of documentation. And I knew that I might find it in the Library of Congress. And this was back when I was teaching in the seminary in Pennsylvania, as I like to call it. And I called my godson, one of my godsons, who happened to live in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the time, to fly out to Pennsylvania. We drove down to Washington and spent, I think, probably most of the morning and a part of the early afternoon in the Library of Congress looking for this piece of information. We eventually found it. But the atmosphere, even in the early 90s in that town, was so oppressively foul. It wasn't just evil and it wasn't just corrupt. It was foul. And my godson and I, when we found the piece of information, we just kind of turned and looked at each other and said, are you feeling what I'm feeling? And we both kind of agreed there was just something in the field or in the right. atmosphere that we just had to get out of there.
And oh my God. I went out 66 down 81. I crossed the Shenandoah River and I just went, phew.
Yeah.
Phew.
Yeah. We did the exact same thing. I know exactly what you're talking about. That is the last place on earth I ever want to visit because it is just, it's just awful. It is whatever they did with the Masonic and occult architecture and plan for that city, it's working. You know.
So I spent a lot of time in Tennessee, and I have to tell you, I have so much admiration and respect for the people of Tennessee and the culture that they share and promote. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. So I'll tell you a little story. I was driving to a dinner and going down Route 24, sort of in the middle of the state, and the traffic was very heavy, and the cars in the fast lane were going much faster than the middle and side lane, and a series of cars went flying by going, I don't know, 10, 20 miles per hour faster than I was in the middle lane. And just as they went by, a ambulance got on the highway. It came on the exit and it had flashing lights but no sirens. So the convoy cars immediately stopped or immediately slowed down, got in the right-hand lane and stayed there for the 5 minutes it took for this ambulance to slowly go by them. And it was such a shocking demonstration of good manners and thoughtfulness, you know, care and concern for their fellow man. I thought, this is why I love Tennessee. Mm-hmm. It's like that all the time. The kindness, the civility. If you look at the pressure the people in the legislature are under, and yet their kindness and civility and good manners, right. It's extraordinary.
Right.
It's absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, people with the strongest possible disagreements still capable of, you know, managing, and there are tremendous rules about civility. And then watching these Bloomberg activists poured all over them, it's so infuriating to see that done to them because they're such an extraordinarily, you know, there's such extraordinary efforts to be of service. And they're only paid, I think it's $27,000 a year for what they do. I mean, they're probably, I'm sure they're not working at, they're working at less than minimum wage. And so to see, I don't know, it's just, it's the culture. I think the Southern states are doing remarkably well. One of the reasons is that culture is attracting people. Yes. You know, they are flooding in from California. They are flooding in from Illinois. They are flooding in from New York. And of course, one of the reasons is the lower taxes. And one of the reasons is they were a better jurisdiction during the pandemic. But I think also in such a high friction world, people want to be around other people who have good manners and are kind.
Have you read the books of Morris Berman yet?
No, I haven't.
You must read him. His two books in particular that I'm thinking of, I'll have to remember the titles and send, but you must read him because he goes into this aspect of Southern culture versus what he and others would call the Yankee culture. And in addition to that, I'd also recommend some of the writings of Professor Clyde Wilson. Now, Professor Wilson, I've got to warn you, is an unapologetic, old-fashioned Southerner.
Uh-huh.
Unapologetic. But he's interesting to read because he will give you a very different perspective of what happened in this country culturally. And what fascinates me is that Berman is a Northeastern liberal who sees the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And is writing about it from that perspective. There is something to Southern, you know, I'm a displaced Northerner, just like you. I'm from South uh-huh. Dakota. And I much prefer living here than anywhere up there, even in my home state of South Dakota. And don't get me wrong, I like South Dakota, and I like the atmosphere and culture there. But there is something different in the South that is much more to my liking. There is some sort of resonance or field, as you say, and I'm with you. I think there are a lot of people that would normally be in national politics, but they see what's going on, and they just don't want any part of it. And again, I go back to the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Rome becomes increasingly irrelevant.
Right.
To the functioning of the Western Empire until the point is reached finally that you don't have a Western Empire anymore. You've got a bunch of little kingdoms that are formed from the parts of it that have broken off.
So the question we're discussing really is, where are the cultures that can turtle through this high friction world? And what I'm seeing in Tennessee is I'm seeing a culture that can manage better than most. So what I see in the Netherlands is a culture that can manage better than most.
Yeah, I was going to say the Netherlands, yeah. Hungary, Tennessee.
Switzerland.
Yeah, Switzerland. I think you have strong possibilities in Italy and France.
Yes, Italy. I clearly vote for Italy. Yeah. The French government is so hard on the French.
I mean, this is the other problem. The government in France is just wacko nuts, but the French themselves
are quite sane,
yeah. And you know, and they're nice people. Again, it's the sane versus the insane.
The Italians are so wonderful. It is impossible to be in Italy and not just love the Italian people. They mm-hmm. are so remarkable, and so they're so much fun to be around.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, they're very warm, and they're very they think of their fellow man. They reach out. They extend themselves. I don't know if I told you, in December I was at La Scala for the most incredible opera I have ever seen in my life. No, it was incredible because it was Verdi's last opera, and here's the thing. I have seen many operas at the top opera houses with great opera singers. This is the first I've ever seen where every player, every singer is an A-level singer. It was unbelievable. You know, and people say La Scala is the best. I mean, that was Verdi's home opera.
What was Verdi's last opera?
Wait, was it Don Giovanni?
When you said that, I'm scratching my head trying to remember.
Was it Don Giovanni? I can't even remember.
The last Mozart. Don Giovanni's Mozart.
No, it was Verdi's last opera. It was his Milanese opera. Wait a minute. Don Carlos.
Don Carlos? Okay.
Yep, and it's the one, it's so long that they have several versions to shorten it up.
Yeah.
And it's one of his last. It's not his last. I've seen Falstaff, which I think Falstaff is absolutely one of his best.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Anyway, okay. I knew it was Don. kept thinking Don Giovanni.
That's Mozart.
Okay. Yes, I know. Anyway, it was incredible. It was so beautiful. So it's hard not to love the Italians. Okay, so should we go back to weaponized migration? Because we haven't talked about what's happening to the cities. So we had talked about the idea of you're poisoning one population, replacing it with another. Right. And you certainly have it both in Europe and the United States. But one of our questions was city struggle, how's your town managing? And I think, you know, we did an incredible Salier report on weaponized migration many years ago with a professor from Tufts who, you know, was really her area of scholarship. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you're seeing is the population would be pushing back much more against the control grid if it wasn't overwhelmed by certain phenomena. And if you look at the extent to which migration is overwhelming the social systems and the local budgets in certain areas. So in New York, if you look at what is happening to the budget, it's really, you know, municipal governments are being forced, whether it's their budgets or their time, you know, it can be overwhelming dealing with this.
Right.
And you don't have time to push back against the control grid because you're managing this influx of enormous amounts of people. Now, the one thing I would say is we've seen this game with the Texas governor, you know, invoking the invasion clause and asserting this and that. But in fact, when you go down and you get reports from the border, it's a media show. It's not a real fight.
Right.
It doesn't look to me like the Texas governor is really asserting sovereignty. It's more a show.
Interesting.
So, and then, you know, I get reports in El Paso, you know, tens of thousands of people cross the border every day to work. So, you know, and then they go back home across the border that night.
Right.
So there's a, you know, the reality of life on the border is very different than the media show. And I think we have to be very, very careful about not falling prey to the media show. And the reality is we're watching enormous number of people being financed up to the border and then crossing the border and then being shipped all over the United States.
Yep. Yeah.
And, I don't know any way to stop this other than cutting off the money.
Yeah.
I keep coming back to the money, and every time I talk about the money, I often feel like people are thinking, it's almost as though I'm being heartless because I don't want to talk about how upset we are about this happening. You know, I don't want to discuss the emotional aspects. I want to discuss what's the action. And, you know, to me, the action that works is if you allow the federal government to continually operate financially outside of the law, then they're going to do things like this.
Right. All right.
You have to cut off the money.
And we're back to your escrow idea.
Right.
Which, you know, I hope that you're able to get it out of committee and on the floor to a vote.
That escrow was just in association with a mortgage for moratorium. If the federal government basically abrogated the laws and its contracts in 9 different ways. I think the question is there merit to putting forward a proposal where this is done now simply because the money is being spent in criminal ways?
What I am convinced of is whether or not a bill like that would pass in Tennessee. The mere fact of such a bill getting out of committee and onto the floor for consideration and a vote, the idea itself will spread from there to other states, and it will spread fast and quickly.
Right.
And sooner or later, one state or perhaps, you know, a group of them will pass it. And it needs to be done. The sooner the better.
Right. And so it's Utah with an X, and now it's Louisiana with a who.
Yep.
You know, all you need are one or two, and then it goes. So... okay, well, let's turn to story 16, globalizing the military, DOD, and NATO. So we've discussed the push to get NATO, you know, much more deeply involved in Europe. We have this huge base going into Romania, and now we have Niger kicking out the African command. The polls in Africa have been shocking because they show very high trust of the African nations for Russia and very low trust for the UK and the US.
Well, can you blame them?
No, I don't blame them at all.
Has the United States treated Africa any differently than the great colonial powers of Europe? No.
No, so it hasn't. So I understand why it's that way, but I'm very shocked to see the strategy. I mean, the strategy that I see globally is you have people all around the world saying the United States is not agreement capable. And then the question comes down to whether it's the central banks printing money or the weapon reinforcing. If you're going to rule an empire, global empire, by force, do you have the force to pull it off?
Right. Right.
And that is the conundrum. You know, what is the plan?
Well, they're criminally insane, and ultimately they may have convinced themselves that they have a plan, but all they really have is an organization to their insanity. In other words, they have an outline, step one, step two, step three, but the end result is still insanity and it's still criminality. So in that sense, they have a plan, but I don't see that they have one.
So really one plan don't. They have, they've been bringing in the populations that have been coming in across the southern border.
Right.
You have been bringing in people clearly with military training.
Absolutely.
And we've seen videos of these camps stockpiling military trained aged men.
Yeah.
And the Senate trying to pass a law saying, you know, a path for, you know, a wholesale path for citizenship is for these migrants is to go into the military. So it looks to me like you're planning on a very significant portion of the U.S. military being a growth from the migrant populations. And the other question I have is, will there be a military draft in 2024 or 2025?
Well, I'm not seeing a draft. I am seeing them trying to, they are failing to meet their recruiting requirements, number one. And this may be a way to get a hold of the manpower that they need. And it's very simple why they're having these recruiting requirements. I think there's two reasons. I think a significant segment of the population that would normally have been the population that the military relied on for its volunteers has woken up and decided, no, going off to fight for the poppy fields of Afghanistan for the Carlyle Group, and having my legs blown off by a landmine in Iraq, this ain't for me. So in other words, I think the narrative and the American mythology is crumbling to the point that it's affecting the military's ability to recruit.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, no one wants to join a woke military.
Right.
That's just pure and simple.
Right.
And especially the population that is the most supportive of the military in the past. So they've got to replace the military manpower situation somewhere, and that's the border. And the reason I was laughing, Catherine, is that's Rome. Because effectively what you're doing is you are creating, first of all, a mercenary military, and a mercenary military can be bought off eventually.
Right, right, right. And they usually turn against the guys
And they usually turn against the guys that are financing them. I'm looking at the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, in other words. And the other thing that, that I think they're doing this for is the population base that they normally would recruit from in America is the same population base that would be very unlikely if orders were ever given to the American military to turn on its own people. That very population is very unlikely to do so. Right. Mercenaries from other countries
will do so.
You betcha they would. Yeah, absolutely. No compunction.
So one of the headlines in this area is an interview Chuck Schumer gave, yep, where he was trying to get the huge and hideous amounts of money to keep funding the Ukraine effort. And he, yep, exploded in anger and said, if the bill was killed, American would regret it. Ukraine would lose the war. Israel would not defeat Hamas. The Palestinians would starve to death, and America might fight in Europe.
Well, again, you know, this, the problem here, Catherine, is, and you and I have talked about this before, we are not getting the same bang for the buck that we're spending on military spending that Russia is.
Right.
You know, we're spending all this money, and what are we getting? We're getting aircraft carriers that don't work.
So we're spending this, yeah, but we're spending this money for to affect political control.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have not, the military budget is not organized to produce a successful military. It is organized, right, to produce a successful stock market,
yep,
and to engineer elections and political control.
Yeah.
And because we've been willing to throw so much money at it, we've been able to still dominate globally. But now that is being tested. You know, Baltimore is an example of the test. And my question now is, do we now have non-state militaries which are more powerful than the U.S. military?
Oh, in some respects, I think that's probably already true. Yes.
Well, let's face it, Byrd got his head handed to him in Antarctica in the 40s, right?
Well, yeah. And not only do I think that there are such non-state militaries, I am I'm convinced, for reasons that I may or may not be able to put into a book someday, but I'm convinced that those non-state militaries have access to weapons of mass destruction, including, right, nuclear weapons. Not that those, right, are at the top of the list anymore, but, right, no, I really think the business model for the American military is exactly the same business model as for healthcare. Keep people sick because we can make profits out of that. We can make lots of profits out of wars that we have no intention to win. We just stay in them and prolong them as long as possible. That's the business model. And
well, it's the defeat by guys,
right,
in sandals. So the guys in, right, sandals defeat us every time, except we make billions of dollars doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. But sooner or later, that business model runs up against a real military. And that's the problem.
Well, here's the thing. If you look at how much money is getting spent,
It's
extraordinary. We have a chart up on the website of the sort of military spending globally, and that's only the overt budgets. That doesn't include,
exactly,
going out the back door.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So now part of this we know is the grab for oil and gas. And one of my questions is how much of what's happening in the Middle East is really, you know, with Russia and the commodity producers organizing in the BRICS and giving a hard time, how much of this is a reminder to everybody in the Middle East that they need to play ball with the empire? And that's why we want Israel doing that. And that's why we're here, why we're there.
It could be a lot of it has to deal with that. The other possible scenario is that they want to keep the Middle East out of the oil game by constant warfare.
Right.
I can see that possibility, but
right,
it's a remote one.
Right. There, one of the stories we have in here is Russia rejects USC annexations, and you brought that up before.
Yeah.
But I see the war over fishing stock and, you know, and various right. things going on in the oceans as a very important part of sort of the global military picture.
Well, it's an important part of the global military picture, but I think it's also a very important part of Mr. Globaloney's financial picture.
Right.
I really do think that they're facing such a financial tsunami that they are desperate to do anything to write off all the bad paper and get their books back in balance. Of course, there's a solution that they're not willing to try, and that's just a debt jubilee. But I don't see them going for that at all. So they've got to do something.
Why give up your control system? I think the debt is part of the control system.
Precisely. Well, precisely.
If you lock in a global CBDC and digital ID and token system, and that will give you complete control without the debt. Yep. That's when the debt goes away.
Yep.
Let's talk about, apparently, we saw this at the meet and greet. One person brought up the fact that they'd made another silly comment on UFOs.
And yes.
I'm not current on what DOD says about the UFOs because I just, you know, I mean, it's like.
I'm with you. At this stage, I'm as serious as I can be here, Catherine. I don't pay any attention at all to what right. the federal government says. They're liars.
Well, but here's the thing. I mean, it's a little bit like if the New York Times, the Washington Post had an essay on virtue, would you read it? Of course not.
No, of course not. No.
Of course not, right?
No.
Okay, so the DOD, you know, made
I'll read
another...
Aristotle if he writes an essay on virtue. Oh, yeah, okay, right. fine.
Right. But, anyway, no. So it never, you know, I just paid no attention to any of it, but...
Yeah,
I think the time is coming when, whether it's the question, what the hell is going on in Antarctica, or, you know, what about the trillions of dollars of unusually advanced hardware flying around this planet? You know, the time is coming where, I don't know if you remember this, right after 9/11, I wrote an article called What's Up with the Black Budget, where I talked about the U.S. Navy trying to persuade me that aliens exist and live among us. And you know, and I talked about, you know, we have to look at the black budget and we have to get serious about all the advanced. I mean, we are interacting on this planet with one or more advanced civilizations who are separate.
Right.
You know, they think they have separate laws, they have separate technology.
Right.
I don't, you know, they could be human or not. They could be co-located on the planet. They could be from the moon. I don't know. But one of the things I know is there's one or more separate advanced civilizations that we're dealing with, and that's one of the reasons everything feels so weird, right?
Right, right.
Right, and that's why I say when somebody, you know, it wasn't necessarily the Russians that blew up the bridge in Baltimore. It could have been, you know, a breakaway civilization.
Non-state actor, breakaway civilization.
Right.
E.T., you know, whoever.
Who?
You know, we've got lots of players. I pay Catherine ever since they started this business of. You'll notice after they successfully shut down the secret space program conferences with the whole Corey Good marketing.
The
blue chicken op. Ever since that time, they've been playing around with government disclosure. They're finally coming out and admitting all this. And again, it was all theater and it was all BS.
So my favorite thing during the blue chicken op. So after we had two great conferences and it was our Dutch partners who did them one in 2014, one in 2015, all the videos are still available. It was fabulous. Right. And so in comes swarming this effort by Gaia TV, which is, I think the largest investors off and on were Fidelity, I think BlackRock, Fidelity, Vanguard, and there was one other, the Lucas's wife's firm, Ariel Investments, out in Chicago, I think at one point. And I tried to get everybody to call those firms and say, you know, you are one of the largest brokerage holders of treasury bills and bonds. Why is it you're also financing a disinformation op about UFOs?
Right.
Right. What and what does it have to do with your U.S. Treasury position? You know,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Anyway, so but
no, I don't. None of this stuff. I pay no attention to it because number one, if the government's saying it, they're a bunch of liars, and I don't trust anything they say.
Here's what I do think we have to do. We have, and we'll get to unanswered questions shortly. We have to keep talking about what the world is going on in Antarctica, and what yes. are these separate civilizations, and how is the state of play on this planet related to tribute or money or demands that they have? One of your speeches at the 2015 conference that was so great was you said, you know, this is behaving like a treaty obligation.
Yes.
And, you know, I've always said the financial system is behaving like an open system right. where every year you have to produce a dividend, and the pressure to produce a bigger and bigger dividend is greater and greater. Yeah. And I just think we have to step back and start. I think it's incumbent on the sane to stop pretending that these issues are not with us. And I think it's incumbent on the sane to look at them. Because
yes, I agree.
You know, for 30 years, I've lived, you know, with a lot of sane people who want to pretend that's not happening.
Right.
And, right. and you know, I said it was like the siege of Leningrad and the Stepford Wives. You know, sometimes it's like the Phoenix Lights and the Stepford Wives.
Yeah. Well, right. again, I totally agree. And the problem for both of us, I think, was that we were not able to make sense of the financial system without the recognition that there was a whole lot of money being drained from the system, and it was never showing up in any conventional method of analysis that could explain that kind of drain.
Right.
If the money were being siphoned off and to some other part of the planetary financial system, it would be showing up as hyperinflation well before
right.
now, and it never did.
Right.
So, you know, where is it going?
Right. I'm laughing. You did a great interview with Hoagland. Joseph Farrell, I've got a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That was a good one.
Well, that was years ago, if I remember correctly.
No, this one was, or maybe they just republished it.
When was this one?
It was republished in February 2024.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, you know, this is the, you know, this is the same problem that he had when, you know, he got started with all this business. There was just something outside the system narrative that you could not account for. And it had something to do with space.
Yeah, and it cost $21 trillion.
And it cost $21 trillion. And that was just, you know, a couple of years ago. Who knows right. how much since the end of World War II.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, and that's just counting our budget. That's not counting the Nazis, who I think are responsible for this whole idea of a secret space program and a two-track system and so on. So, yeah, I discount all of this stuff that the government is saying about it because, again, it, and I think the reason that it's being rejected is that people are simply not buying any narrative that the government is creating uncritically.
Right.
That's the problem.
So story number 17 is message control, media, DOD, yes. State Department, White House. We, you know, and it started, if you look at the Missouri and Louisiana case, mm-hmm. you know, CISA, this ridiculous organization, took the position that the minds of the American people are part of the national security infrastructure, and they have the right to assert jurisdiction over them. I'm serious.
No. Yes. I know they said,
it's in the court documents.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous, and and it's funny if you look at the things they're threatening to do to control the narrative. They're so remarkably, you know, they're so remarkably tyrannical. So yep. you know, we have Bobby Ann Cox litigating the healthcare regulations that say I can pick up anybody I want and throw them under quarantine for as long as I want with no due process
yep.
and no proof that they're sick. Really? Right. Why do you need that, pals?
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, but at the same time, if you look at our society, we do not have the money to put 325 million people in jail.
Yeah.
So how's this supposed to work? You've got to scare everybody, and I don't think they can. And the reason I don't think they can, you know, there's a point at which you just start laughing. One of our heroes this for the quarter was the guy from UFC, the head of the UFC, saying, you know, I don't tell my players what to think. I don't tell them what to say. Free speech, brother.
Right, exactly.
Or Massey on the floor of the high. You know, Thomas Massey's been the hero of the week or pushback of the week so many times on the Slayer Report, I can't count. But he came out with a statement on the TikTok ban, which was unbelievable. And, you know, I mean, basically, I just don't think you can shut everybody up because it's reached the point where they say, this is ridiculous. Anyway, so if you were running the White House or the State Department, what would you do other than fire Victoria Nuland, which they've already done?
What would I do?
If you wanted to control, what would you do? If you wanted to control the narrative, what would you do?
Well, to put it under absolute control, I'd nationalize the media, period. First thing, right off the bat. Just turn CBS, NBC.
So one question is, have they used the missing money in essentially to buy them secretly?
Oh, I have no doubt that they've got secret interests. But even if they did, there's no way that those interests could account for all the money sloshing around.
No way. Absolutely. But one of the things I do want to mention, Joseph, during the pandemic, we saw corporations act against the laws related to fiduciary obligations to shareholders and to employees.
Yes.
And proceed to do things as if they had received a national security directive.
Right.
And it looked to me like they were under military law.
Yes.
And having military law overriding, you know, shareholder or fiduciary obligation laws. And they were doing things that was against the best interests of their shareholders and against the best interests of their employees. You know, and for example, airlines, you're vaccinating pilots with vaccines which shred their veins and cause blood clots.
Right.
When we know that flying, you know, increases the chance of blood clots. I mean, you can't tell me you care anything about safety.
No, you can't. And I totally agree. But the important, you just made, I think, a hugely important point that the behavior of corporations during the planned scamdemic was like they were under military orders.
I think they were.
I'll go even further. I think there is a good possibility that at some point in recent years, for whatever reason, we've been de facto under continuity of government operation.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
So, you know, DOD, the military, has always been the most admired organization, or for many years, the most admired organization. But DOD is missing $20 trillion, and DOD has just finished engineering a mass atrocity against the human race and the American people. And how much longer can DOD, you know, and DOD poisoned their own soldiers and pilots?
Right.
How much longer can DOD be a respected institution in this country?
It's already lost it. That's the whole point of the recruiting business that we were talking about just a few minutes ago. I think the U.S. military has lost its own recruitment base. Case in point, they recently rewrote the mission statement at West Point. And I even blogged about this. They dropped the words of duty, honor, and country.
Right.
From the mission statement of West Point. That's a thin step away from changing the military oath, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
So
when they changed the General Accounting Office to the General Accountability Office. Is right. it okay? Now it's really out of control.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, right. they, as far as I'm concerned, the military has lost the respect that it once had. And it was inevitable if your business model is to fight wars in order to lose them, but make lots of money. Who wants to serve in the military with that kind of track record?
Right.
You know, who?
Somebody who wants the pathway to citizenship.
Citizenship, yeah.
Yeah. Who's coming for asylum and
yeah.
Okay, so one thing we noticed in the first quarter is the Jeffrey Epstein story still has not gone away. And a lot of money disappeared down that hole, and it did a lot of brain research, right?
Yeah.
And we know that mind control is one problem that we're dealing with. So I've always found the Madoff and Epstein connection to brain research at MIT and Harvard to be of great interest.
It is. It is.
And the fact that Trump put as head of Operation Warp Speed, a man whose claim to fame was brain machine interface.
Yep.
Okay. So story number 18, the downward spiral in big business values. We talked about this in the part one, but we are seeing so many corporations adopt a model that is fundamentally criminal. So I talked about the video that with the allegations that Dollar General is putting one price on the yes. shelf and then another at the register, and they've been paying fines all along, but they're doing this systematically because it makes them a great deal of money. And I told you about during travel, all the experiences I've had with hotels and car rentals where I've determined that's not a hotel company, that's not a motel company, that's not a car company. It's fundamentally a financial fraud.
Yes.
And the car company or the hotel, it's just a front for financial fraud. And I think the time has come when many people in America, and I don't have these problems in Europe at all. Europe is exactly the opposite. But I think the time has come in America, if you're dealing with a large corporation, you need to assume that they're a criminal enterprise.
Criminal, yes.
Unless your due diligence proves to you that they're not.
Right. I would totally agree.
Right.
And I would add a corollary to that, that the bigger the institution, the more likely it is that you're dealing with something fraudulent.
So I do a screen. So my second company is an investment screen, and one of the most enthusiastic things I do, one of the most gratifying things I do, is I look at great companies all around the world. And what's remarkable to me, Joseph, is how many great companies there still are. And they're fundamentally lawful. They do, mm-hmm. They do good things. They do intelligent things. They do productive things. And when you look at the really great ones, it takes your breath away because they've worked for generations to be the best in their, one of my favorite companies that we have in the brochure for the screen company is it makes bicycle components. And if you look at the market share they have globally in bicycle components, and they're not from a company from a country that's dollar based, so they're from outside the Anglo-American alliance, and yet they command the global market in certain bicycle components, and the reason is because they are so excellent. If you look at the quality of their disclosure, it takes your breath away when you realize every American company could have this kind of disclosure, but they don't. But there are plenty of those companies. Now, here's what's interesting. So we have approximately 750 companies in our screen. And as a result of the pandemic, I had to throw 80 companies off the screen. That's how many companies, in my opinion, were destroyed as productive companies as a result of the pandemic.
So all the
airlines had to go. It's just like, no, yep. I'm sorry. If you jeopardize the safety of your passengers intentionally and knowingly in the way that they did, that's not okay.
No.
Anyway, it was like losing friends. I mean, it was pretty tragic. But there's still many great companies. I will tell you, though, if you look at the bifurcation in the stock market, what is happening, and we'll talk about this on the next story, the companies that are acting as criminals are flying because they're I believe it's because they're getting the injections of the, you know, sort of the monetary subsidy, but also because everybody in the know is thinking, oh, well, you know, they've got the, you know, the deep state and the riggers are behind them, so right. they'll do well. So the market's betting on control. It's very frightening to watch. Yeah. I keep buying the good companies because I figure, okay, buy low, right? So story number 19 is the plunder economy moves market. It's frightening. And this is, as you know, my, you know, I try not to worry about this, but I am very worried because what I see is I see the guys who want to rape America getting ready to have a real party after the election. Mm-hmm. And as soon as Trump sewed up the nomination, Steve Mnuchin was out with there was a run on Community Bank of New York, and Steve Mnuchin puts in $1 billion. And then suddenly there's an effort to ban TikTok, and Steve Mnuchin is putting together a group to buy TikTok. And they keep talking about TikTok as though it's some Chinese company, when in fact 60% of the stock is owned by a group of American private equity and LBO firms, including KKR. Mm-hmm. I mean, really?
I know for a fact they're not trying to ban TikTok for the reason that it's owned by China. You know how I know that? Because it's not fucking owned by China. It's just fucking not. 60% of the company is owned by international investors, including U.S. investors. 20% is owned by its founders. The other 20% is owned by the employees, nearly 10,000 of which are U.S. citizens. And I know they're not trying to ban it to protect the private information of Americans from the CCP. Do you know how I know that? Because all American user information is on servers in Texas, already overseen by a U.S. company called Oracle. So we know it's not because it's owned by China. And we know it's not to protect our personal information. So the only valid question is, why do they want to ban it? And the answer to that is, this isn't about TikTok. If you actually take the time and read through the bill that they just passed, here's one very important thing that this bill allows them to do. That is to shut down or take control of any social media platform that they claim interferes with the election. And who would make that determination? President. The president would have complete power on whether or not to shut down a social media platform. Oh, and if that platform wanted to appeal it, that is going to be ruled by the DC Court of Appeals. This concentrates power over all social media platforms that don't want to get in line, that don't want to give the government what they want, that don't want to do what the government says. That's all this is about. See, they tried to do this before. They tried to do it with Facebook and Instagram, but Facebook and Instagram got in line. They didn't do it with Twitter for a while because Twitter was doing what they told them to do. But then once Elon bought it, they tried it again because X wouldn't get in line. But they couldn't build up enough support for that, one, because Elon's a fucking billionaire, and two, because he's an American who's liked, and they couldn't get enough support to shut him down. So now they're trying it again using the specter of Chinese-owned. Aren't you worried about your privacy? Now, if I was worried about my privacy, I wouldn't use Google. I wouldn't use Alexa. I wouldn't shop on Amazon. I wouldn't use facial recognition on my phone. I wouldn't go on Facebook and Instagram because we know they're stealing our information. I wouldn't hold this phone in my hand because we all know it's listening. And people are wondering why the government was able to come together and agree on this. Why wouldn't they? Why would the government not come together and agree on granting themselves power? Because that's all this bill does. It takes away your right to privacy and communication and gives it to them.
And then, of course, we see the Boeing nosedive, which is really frightening because you're talking about the kind of cultural deterioration and corruption in a company that is a nightmare to try and turn around.
I think it's partly cultural. And we talked about that last week, but I think right. I think there's also a possibility that some of it is industrial espionage or covert ops. So
yeah,
in other words, they've created a culture that lends itself to that. Let's put it that way.
Right. Right. And the other thing is once it gets going, right. then every time there's any maintenance problem at all that normally right. would never see a headline or the light of day. Right. You know, everybody gets it out. But now Kayak, which is one of the, you know, the websites where you can make plane reservations, will allow you to screen to only look at flights that don't have Boeing. Right. So if you want to only fly Airbus, you can.
Right. Right.
That's a very powerful market shock.
It's not only a market shock. I don't see it getting any better. I mean, we've got several problems all kind of congealing around the air transportation industry. We've got the diversity, inclusion, equity crowd, or the DAI crowd, as I like to call them. We've got all of that. We've got the ESG business. We've got all the wokery. We've got the typical affirmative action problems that are associated with these types of programs. Then we have the collapse of academic standards, which I also think are going on at Boeing. You know, I warned about this back when I was still teaching in college, that if you continue on the path that you're continuing on in higher education, you're going to have airplanes falling out of the sky. And I literally used that as because you've got incompetent, stupid people doing this. And then you add the quack scenes to all of it, where you're creating some sort of brain fog as a result of these injections.
Right.
Add all that together and you've got a mess.
Right.
You've got a mess. I'm Catherine. Well, it's so
I think
bad.
They thought they could run these planes with software and remote, you know, remote steering.
Maybe they did, but they're not, you know, these people are fundamentally stupid. They're not only insane, but they're stupid. They're insane and stupid because they've never reckoned on the coalescence of the very schemes that they put into play.
So I would say it this way, because my experience is they're quite intelligent. But what I would say is that they are, you know, we had this ceremony you had to go through as a child called Turn Your Heart to Stone. Mm-hmm. They can't tap into the field. They can't. There's a kind of, if you look at the nature of intelligence, you know, one form of intelligence is, you know, reading 1,000 pages of the WHO treaty and being able to take a test on it the next day. Mm-hmm. So let's call that an intellectual intelligence, or reading a biochemistry book and taking a test the next day. So you know, they're going to do very well in that system. But if you want to tap into, if you want to walk into a situation and tap into the field where you are not only perceiving what other people are saying, but you're feeling what they feel, mm-hmm. you know, feeling is an emotional IQ is a much greater source of intelligence than intellectual. And you know, the most intelligent people in the world can combine both effectively.
Right.
So, you know, all the best intelligence I've ever gotten, the intelligence that has constantly saved my life, is because I walk into a situation and I can feel what the other people are feeling. And from that, I can discern what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then I know to go to the right and not the left. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, you're talking about a group who can't, you know, who have difficulty plugging into the field. It's very interesting. I will go sit down at the, you know, with people from the highest echelons of society, and they have no understanding of why people behave the way they behave or what their point of view is, because they're so cut off. And they're much more cut off than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I that's what I mean when I talk about what I used to talk about with George Ann Hughes. You surround yourself with yes men. You know, you've got your Bilderberg groups and your Davos set and the Big Sur crowd and so on and so forth. And when you surround yourself with people of like mind all the time, it's just an echo chamber and you become progressively more stupid. And that's, I think, what they've done. Is they can't think outside of the box that they've put themselves in.
Well, sometimes I'm tempted to do the same because, you know, if you do what I do or you do, you know, the way everybody thinks they can help you is tell you what's wrong with you.
Well, right. But, you know, everybody needs an echo chamber. But, you know, the problem is making it a steady diet. And that's all these people do.
Well,
it's a steady diet of the same old, same old. They don't want to know anything outside of their worldview.
You know, you and I did this great interview called Who is Mr. Global, where we also got into why is Mr. Global behaving the way he does. And I think, you know, I think it's a lot harder job than most people envision. You know, you're having to manage a world where the average person is so lacking in the kind, you know, your map is so different than everybody else's map. It makes it very hard to collaborate. Okay, story number 20 is your energy access. And as we've seen before, when people start to bet against the dollar, suddenly these wonderful headlines come out. The one this year was in the first quarter, scientific breakthrough in nuclear fission could launch new era of clean energy.
Ah, yes.
Here's my question. I think one of the reasons Mr. Global may be going for total control is so he can use breakthrough energy.
Well, yeah. We've speculated on that many times before. And, you know, there's the old story about JP Morgan shutting down Tesla's wireless power because he couldn't, you know, he couldn't meter it. Which is another way of saying because he couldn't control it. Possibly. I'm more interested in the fact that every now and then, you know, it seems to be like every 6 months or so, they trot out the latest fusion breakthrough story. I mean, it's as predictable as clockwork. And nothing ever changes. You know, we're no nearer controlled fusion now than we were in 1955. And basically, we're just updating those designs that for controlled fusion that were first created and dreamt up in 1955. We've tweaked them. That's all we've done. So I'm not seeing any breakthrough public energy process. Unless, and this is going to sound terribly paradoxical and stupid, I don't see any breakthrough unless there is a real decentralization breakthrough.
Right.
I really don't. And that's, I know that sounds counterintuitive, but that's what I think.
So one of the things that has happened to help you know, when I say that climate change is the cudgel used to hit you over the head and steal, is the absurdity of the whole electrical car model is finally, it's finally, you know, one of the times we made Massey the hero is when he got the Secretary of Energy up there and he just skewered him because Massey is a brilliant MIT engineer, MIT trained engineer, and he just read him chapter and verse on how everything they were proposing was a lie.
Yes.
There wasn't enough electricity in the world to, you know, to do what their vision just made. It was absolutely mathematically insane. And it was just a lie unless, you know, you had to assume that it would work if we massively depopulated or, you know, I mean, it was just ridiculous. And so people are finally beginning to realize that. And of course, one of the great stories in the annual wrap up was Hertz and all these other rental cars are dumping all their electric cars. They want nothing to do with them.
Not too far from here, there, as you know, there is a shopping center. Okay. It's about 2 miles from here. And this was one of the first shopping centers in this area to put in a Tesla electric vehicle recharging stations. Place in the parking lot of the shopping center. And it's been there for maybe 2 years. I have never seen one Tesla. And I know they're in town because I've driven around and seen them, but I have never seen one ever using those recharging stations, ever. Right. So talk about colossal failure. Just imagine the money it costs to install, I think there's maybe 16 or 20, somewhere around that number of these stations over there. Imagine the money it costs to put those in and multiply that on a national level. The waste. And you've got to wonder, and this is, I'm glad you brought this up, because the thing that strikes me is, okay, if I wanted to launder a lot of money, if I were really... If I wasn't able to mulct enough money out of a hidden system of finance and black budget, how might I be able to launder a lot of money? Electric vehicles and charging stations that don't get used but are going to cost a lot of money to, and we've got to get the right contractor. You know, it would be so easy to do.
Yeah.
I think you're looking at a huge operation here, and it was never about electric vehicles. It was about more money stealing and fraud.
So, we did a great series on the 21st century approach to energy with Charlie Stevens, and he calls it the racket.
It is.
It is a racket.
That's what I'm saying. This was all a racket. This was a fraud from get go.
Yeah, so I'll never forget, I had a wonderful client who went to Germany for a month. He took his whole family to Germany for vacation and sort of, you know, getting helping his kids see the world. And he rented a Volkswagen in Germany that was the same one he had in the United States. And what he discovered is he got massively more mileage on the same car in Germany. And the reason was, in America, Volkswagen is required to significantly decrease the mileage by law. Mm-hmm. And so they can create a car that gets massively more mileage, but they're not allowed to because the U.S. wants a much lower mileage performance. Yep. So that, you know, the different gasoline sales taxes stay high.
Yep.
Yep. So what is this problem with global warming, really? Anyway, but Charlie does a great job of just slicing apart the rackets and showing you why all the different energy spins are complete hooey. Anyway, so energy, your energy access, this is a world where deciding how you provide for your own energy, I swear anything, you know, if I had the time, I would sit down and figure out how to get off the grid, because if there's one thing I don't want to plug into, it's their electrical system. I think taking the time and spending the money to figure out how to get off the grid is really worth it. So those were our stories for part two. So let me just go through them again. Mr. Global's Many Faces of Control and Genocide was story 11. Story 12 was the pushback. Let me get farmers pushback loud and long. And that, I must say, that's a beautiful thing to watch all throughout the first quarter. The who coup, would who fake ratification? And I think the pushback against the who is strong and growing. And we've pierced behind the veil, thanks to Merrill and her colleagues, to show they're lying. They're lying about they have the agreement. They don't have a consensus. They don't have an agreement. My favorite WHO video was in 2019. I don't know if you remember this, but it was December 2019, and it was coming into when they did the pandemic. You had the WHO bring together all the global heads of the vaccine programs all around the world, and they're sitting at the WHO, and Heidi Larson, anthropologist from London, gives a presentation that the increased vaccine hesitancy is because doctors and families don't see scientific proof that vaccines are safe and effective. And then what comes out in this ensuing discussion is there is no such scientific proof that vaccines are safe and effective, which is a problem, because how are you going to stop the hesitancy if you don't have scientific proof that they're really safe and effective? At which point the head of Nigeria, you know, Nigeria being a troublemaker, says, well, wait a minute. I don't want just proof that individual vaccines are safe and effective. I want to know that the cocktail of putting all these vaccines together in one tiny little body are safe together, and the heavy schedule together, the cocktail, is safe and effective. And then everybody's looking at each other, because if we don't have science to prove that one is safe and effective, how in the world are we going to do that for the heavy schedules of the cocktail?
Right.
And you realize, oh, you know something? The emperor has no clothes. The emperor has no clothes. The whole thing is, you know, it just goes to show you can get billions of people, or you can spend billions of dollars and get lots of highly educated people to pretend that something is legitimate when it's not.
Yep.
I mean, there's a reason Mr. Global doesn't respect us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look how easy it is to get us to go along with genocide.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I hate to say it, that was always their rule. If you can get everybody to go off sides, then they're a fair target too. That's the rule. Okay, so let me, I got waylaid. So story number 14 is the global elections. And think about it, 74% of the global population is experiencing election. Remarkable. 15, weaponized migration, cities struggle. How's your town managing? 16, globalizing the military, DOD and NATO. We didn't talk about the Jedi contract and the fact that the military and the intelligence agencies now are all in the corporate clouds with the big tech firms. And that gives them the ability to do radical reengineering of the whole government and globalize it. You can basically, you know, the coup continue by moving the bureaucracy into the cloud and taking control. Okay, 17, message control, media, DOD, State Department, White House. And have they nationalized the media? Big question, but they think your brain is national security infrastructure. 18, the downward spiral in big business values continues. 19, the plunder economy moves markets. And make no mistake, if you look at what's going on in the stock market, unfortunately, it's the plunder economy and the control grid that's winning. And then 20 is your energy access. So that's our top 10, our second top 10 stories, so 11 through 20. So now, Joseph, let's move to unanswered questions. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
So we did not do a lot of changes in the unanswered questions because the same questions keep coming up again and again and again. And you can go through at the website, you can go through the unanswered questions page. One thing I will say, I can't tell you how many people over the last quarter have asked me, who is Mr. Global? And I've said, you know, Dr. Joseph Farrell and I recorded a great program called Who is Mr. Global? And you ought to go listen to it because it really, you know, the discussion hasn't changed that much.
No.
And it was really a great recording. And I want to recommend that to you if you want to know sort of what the issues are. And that's why I think I'm glad we talking about the black budget and the UFOs, because, you know, we're going to have to go down those rabbit holes if we're going to figure this out. Mm-hmm. A second thing that came up was there is another really good sign. There's much more willingness to talk about mind control programming. And, you know, you did a great book a couple years ago on all the different layers of mind control, from education to propaganda to, you know, entrainment technology. And I think we've got to figure that out. We've got to figure out how to protect ourselves from it. And we've got to understand the impact it's having on family, friends, and neighbors and colleagues. So I think mind control and very sophisticated technology is a serious problem.
Yes, and, I do too.
Yeah, and Ulrich Honegger and Elsa von Hamlin have both agreed to do more programming this year on mind control. And so you're going to be seeing a lot more from Saleri on this topic. But I'm enthusiastic that people are willing to sort of, you know, contemplate, you know, the fact that this is part of what we're dealing with. Under risk management, we see this because of the Baltimore Bridge collapse. I think, you know, we are dealing with very advanced technology, and most people do not understand what it is or how it operates. But whether it's, you know, cyber warfare or, you know, directed energy weapons or, you know, we're looking at a lot of invisible weaponry. And I, for one, if I could get an encyclopedia of invisible weaponry and technology, I would just love it. But, you know, the general population needs to understand more about how this stuff really exists. And that includes weather warfare. I think more and more people are finally beginning to believe that weather warfare is real. And that's why these geoengineering bills being submitted in Tennessee and New Hampshire are good. Okay, obviously AI is a big topic of discussion. We've got our third quarter wrap-up was on AI, and we'll be publishing that in a month or two. Anything you want to say about AI?
No, not right now, other than to emphasize the connection between that and the mind manipulation stuff in terms of soft manipulation. I think you open yourself up if you're overly reliant on the internet for information.
Right.
Particularly search engines and so on. I think I've always thought that that AI is already in existence, and I think that to a certain extent, it's being used by the global elite, by Mr. Globalone, to game things out, and that Mr. Globalone is acting so inhuman because they're just following what the computer spits out and tells them to do.
Well, you know, we saw that description of the targets in Gaza. Right. The Israeli military was using AI to pick the targets so that all the military officers were not legally responsible.
Yeah. Yeah, I can easily see it. Easily.
Right. Right. So I see AI as as much a cover story as an actual phenomena. Okay. So obviously one of the big unanswered questions is how quickly are they moving to complete control of food, of travel, of the financial transactions? And of course, the important question, how do we stop them? And if you look at the state of play between moving for total control in these areas and are pushing back, tell us where you think we are.
In terms of the relationship between the pushback and the total control,
yeah.
Is that what you're?
Yeah.
If I were to express it as a percentage or a ratio, I think at best the pushback is 20% of the overall phenomenon, and the race for control is at 80. However, having said that, if you had asked me to express it in terms of a ratio a year ago, I would have said something like 5% to 95%.
Wow. So it's growing fast.
It's growing very, very fast, particularly this year. And I don't think, I think, quite frankly, the genie is out of the bottle. I don't see it. I don't see Mr. Globalone being able to squeeze things back into the bottle. And that's the other problem he's facing.
Right.
I would even go so far as to say that there may already be a recognition in certain circles of Mr. Globalone's mafioso roundtable that there is already the perception that they cannot succeed in any of their plans. I think.
Well, that's a reason to go to war and you know, to move NATO into the Ukraine and start a nuclear war.
Well, even then, the nuclear war thing, they may be in for some very rough surprises if they try that scenario.
Right.
And by rough surprises, we're not the only nation with a black budget.
Right.
I think they're going to be in for some very, very nasty surprises.
Right.
I'm thinking of one in particular.
Right. Everybody pulls out our most advanced toys and pushes back.
Right.
And the other thing is, you know, if you're Russia, you know what this group did the last time. And the only reason that the U.S. intelligence agencies didn't allow a complete collapse was they were worried that the nuclear arsenal would fall into the wrong hands.
Yep.
And if I'm the Russians, I'm going to assume they figured out how to overcome that problem this time around. And this time they will allow complete devastation. So if I'm the Russians, again, I'm fighting for all the marbles and I will fight to the death.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's, yeah.
You have another factor in play in Russia. And that's the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yes.
There is a book out. I think it's by Martynov, but the actual title of the book is Russian Nuclear Orthodoxy.
Wow.
And it's about how the Russian Church literally stepped in and exercised a staying hand on Russia's nuclear infrastructure and arsenal.
Wow.
It is quite a breathtaking book.
Who's it by, and Joseph?
I think it was Martynov, but I am not exactly certain of that. But that is okay. The title of the book, Russian Nuclear Orthodoxy. And the reason I find that so interesting is that what I came away with having read the book was not only, and it was the current Patriarch of Moscow, by the way, that at the time was a metropolitan that was leading mm-hmm. this effort to make sure that the nuclear infrastructure stayed intact and that the state retained control of the nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. But the thing that I came away from reading that book was the realization that if the church was willing to step in and save the nuclear arsenal and infrastructure, that's the key point.
Right.
And in turn has become so much a part of Russia's current nuclear infrastructure. This means that for the current Russian government, in a way that was not even true under the Soviet Union, that nuclear arsenal is part of Russia's existential identity.
Right.
That people, I hope that sinks into people.
And I would hope part of that is their scientific infrastructure, because they have.
That's absolutely what I'm talking about.
Right. The scientific infrastructure.
Yeah, that's absolutely what I'm talking about.
And that scientific infrastructure has to be appalled by what's happening in the West. Although,
oh,
I would
are.
Point out again, Russia and China were part of the G20 meeting in India, New Delhi, last
yes.
year, and all tipped their hat in loyalty to the BIS, global CBDC, and digital ID infrastructure.
Yeah,
so Russia's fully on board for the control model.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Right. Okay,
and that's disturbing to me.
Very disturbing. You know, and I think it's important to remember that while there are these tensions going on, there is a commitment to the BIS control model that is across all these, mm-hmm. you know, it includes the BRICS. The BRICS are fully mm-hmm. on board. Mm-hmm. It was shocking to read the documents that we published from New Delhi and, you know, the Indians in the lead. So two more things I want to go into while we're in unanswered questions. One of the things I would love to do in the second quarter, if you're willing, is to do a Solari report on what is the moon? question 37. Well, you know, at various times I've done a lot of research on what is the moon and what, you know, are there colonies or civilization on the moon? And, you know, what is the U.S. really doing about the moon? Anyway, and what you realize, the more you research it, the more you realize, oh, my God. You
it's
know.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, so
I would be perfectly happy and willing to do that.
Okay,
yes.
So maybe we'll call it the unanswered questions of the moon. Or okay. The moon, the unanswered questions. Okay, so we've done who is Mr. Global, but we need to talk about the moon. Because I absolutely believe the moon is a watchtower. And whoever is getting the dividend, that's their watchtower. They want to make sure they get their money, right? So there's a lot going on the moon, and I think there are a lot of questions about what is the moon, and you know, what is the Chinese doing on the dark side of the moon? And I don't know if you remember my story of being in Uluru, and one of our smartest subscribers said, he said, well, in 2000, I think it was the year before. So it was about 2017, 2018. I'm sitting in Uluru, and he said, you know, somebody just handed out a contract to Vodafone and Nokia to do a 4G network on the moon. And I was like, no way, no way. And then he sent me the announcement, the headline.
Yeah.
Vodafone put out a press release, you know, that they just signed a contract to provide a 4G network to the moon. I'm like, oh my God.
The Germans did the same thing. And yeah, I know.
Yeah. There's a lot going on the moon. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so maybe I'm second quarter, look forward to the unanswered questions about the moon. The other thing is we published the book review in the first quarter. I read it in the last year, thanks to you. But you and I did a wonderful interview called on your new book, Demon of the Ekor. And then I read Robert Temple's book over Christmas. Mm-hmm. We drove to Prague and then Vienna and then Salzburg and then back to the Netherlands. And I was with somebody who wanted to do all the driving. So I read Robert Temple's book, A New Science of Heaven, about the fundamental nature of plasma in the universe. And it's one of the greatest cases for optimism, your book. So if you read Demon of the Ekor and you read A New Science of Heaven, you come away realizing, you know, no small group of people is going to be able to get together and control this.
No.
This is totally, this is totally
way
out of
control. Beyond their grasp. Way, right. way beyond their grasp.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's just like the, you know, the WHO is gaslighting the world. You know, the WHO is convincing people that they have 190 countries ratifying agreeing to this, and it's just a lie.
Yeah.
And so these folks, you know, the BIS has got everybody believing that they can, you know, do digital IDs and CBDCs, and everybody can get in the control group and really be controlled. And it's, you know, if you look at the fundamental nature of the universe, it just...
You mentioned that the BRICS nations are on board with the BIS and the CBDC. And I'm about 80% convinced of that. The other 20% is thinking, no, this is just what the BRICS nations are telling the BIS.
Right.
And the BIS is being played like a fiddle. So,
well, it's possible because, you know, if you guys aren't agreement capable, why should I be agreement capable?
Yeah, why? Yes, exactly.
Right. I'll just pander to you.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I'll build my own
thing.
And I'll
keep doing whatever it is I want to do anyway.
Right. So it's like, when I bought this watch in Hong Kong, I went to pay with a credit card, and there were two credit card machines. One was for the Chinese credit cards, and the other was for the Western credit cards, because they want nothing to do with the American credit card companies.
I can understand. I can dig that, you know, and the thing that makes me think that maybe they're just blowing smoke at the BIS is that you've got all of these bilateral currency agreements among the BRIC nations, and there's not one of them that I can think of that I recall that's mentioning the BIS as the mechanism for clearing any of this. So, you know, why would you bother? You know, exactly.
Another unanswered questions we should do a Salieri report on is how they laundered the $21 trillion. Because I think the BIS were the big pipes. Absolutely.
Well, they had to be. They're the only ones in any position to be able to do something like that. Other than maybe the Vatican Bank.
No, I think you need the BIS. It's too big, even for the Vatican Bank. There would be too many. There would too many archbishops swinging from bridges. Right? Those Vatican people fight. They can't handle that volume. Okay, so now we turn. Anything else on unanswered questions you want to ask? I really encourage people to go to and many of our discussions, you know, quarter after quarter, year after year, we keep digging into these unanswered questions. So we've done many versions of them. Okay, so I want to turn to inspiration. And in inspiration this quarter, we focused on one event. And I have to say, I am overwhelmed with admiration for this group of people. And that is the Ranchers of the Panhandle.
Ah, yes.
So yes. The Ranchers of the Panhandle, once again, so since 2006, I think they've had 5 major fires. And the last round of fires were brutal. And of course, these were too. But what is extraordinary, and I'm depending on my reports from people on the ground, is, you know, in fire after fire, they get better and better at cooperating and and getting their ranches ready to handle and deal with fire and coming together and dealing with fire together. This time around, there were surprisingly few deaths. And essentially, the entire operation of dealing and putting out the fires was the people of the Panhandle.
Right.
And essentially, the state and federal government showed up after it was over.
After the fact.
In many respects, they showed up to do surveillance and photo ops.
Yep.
And literally, the ranchers just said, get your asses out of here.
Yep.
You know, you don't. And I think the message, you know, the bad news is we're on our own. The good news is what the Panhandle ranchers proved is once you know you're on your own and you work together to deal with it on your own, you do a much better job than having those people in making a mess.
Yep.
So get the insane out of your pockets and out of your mind and out of your operations. Stop expecting anything from them. Just get them out and keep them out and deal with it without them, and you will get a lot more done.
Hear.
And oddly enough, one of the mainstream papers published we put up on the inspiration page a picture of the Bauer brothers who were did a Stories from Smokehouse Creek wildfire. A great video, and it's up there. But at the Wall Street Journal wrote an essay which was beautiful, called "The Spirit of Democracy Rises from the Texas Wildfires." And they started off with a story from Jim Locke. So let me just read it. Jim Locke saw the wildfire rolling in from the west around noon on February 26. Mr. Locke, 48, is a rancher in the Texas Panhandle town of Miami. He's also assistant chief of the Roberts County Volunteer Fire Department. So he mounted up a fire truck and rode out. The blaze turned out to be the Smokehouse Creek Fire, the largest wildfire in Texas history. Mr. Locke was on the truck for the next 40 hours. So I put a note at the top. Hearsay: Jim Locke is the guy who told the state firefighters to get their asses out of Roberts County if they're not going to fight fire.
Good for him. Yeah.
Well, Roberts County in the 2016 election had the highest percentage of any county in the country.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, I love Roberts County. I've been there a couple times, and that's up where Boone Pickens had his ranch.
Yeah.
I can't remember if he was in Roberts or the county above it, but, you know, that's that area. And, you know, I just have to say, I hate this happening to the people of Roberts County. At the same time, I can't tell you how much I admire them and what they've done. The frightening thing is if you look at how much cattle ranching comes from that area, we're talking about a lot of ranchers. You know, it takes 10 to 15 years to grow back a herd. You lose your herd in a fire like this, or, you know, because you lose your grass, you got to sell them off. You know, if you're in your 50s, you may go out. And my concern is a lot of ranchers are going to go out up there because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense for them to stay in given their ages.
Right.
So, and we don't have young ranchers coming up in many respects. So, anyway, it's a real concern that this is going to really feed the consolidation of the meat markets in the United States. So, but I have to say, if you want a great and inspiring example of the spirit and attitude that's going to see you thrive and succeed in the next 5 years, get, you know, take a deep ingestion of coverage of what the Panhandle Ranchers did in the first quarter, and you will absolutely be inspired. So check out that page on inspiration. Okay, well, that is the first quarter wrap up. Again, our theme was U.S. States, the opportunity to lead financial freedom. What I want to say to everybody is, wherever you are on the planet, you've got to push back and insist on financial freedom, because if these guys get financial control, they're going to control everything. You name it, they're going to set the policy. You can control everything, whether there's war or peace, whether, you know, what the healthcare policies are, what the food policies. You've got, you know, essentially almost complete control. And so now is the time to push back. And Joseph, any, I know you're pushing back and you've written some great blog posts warning about, you know, don't get squeezed by gold and some of these other things. But tell us in the second quarter what you're going to be doing and what you want other people. How can, because Giza Death Star is a great website. You have great conversations going on with the with your vid chats and your members. Tell us about what you expect over the second quarter and what you're going to be doing at Giza Death Star.
Well, what I expect is I really think that there's going to be something between now and the American election, that they're going to pull something. What it is, I don't know. I don't know. What I'm trying to emphasize for people is that we are in a war, and I'm not talking just a spiritual war or a metaphorical war. We are in a war, and these people are at war with us.
And each other.
And each other, yes.
Right.
And unfortunately, there are going to be casualties. So what I'm trying to do is to figure out a way, how do I help people fight back? I think 90% of all military operations boils down to two things: logistics, in other words, supply, and intelligence. And I think what my primary focus is always on intelligence. What are they up to? What are their tactics?
Right. Right.
What's their history? You know, what are their patterns? Because that's intelligence that you can actually use. The other part of it is my focus is always on opposing cosmologies. And that's the real spiritual part of the warfare. I don't think things are going to get better until people wake up and realize, especially in this country, that it's not political. The problems of this country are spiritual and cultural.
Right.
Period. And if you really wake up and understand that, that means you're going to start doing the rigorous critique of history that the left and the woke people pretend that they're doing, but they're really not.
So Mary Holland always says that courts follow culture.
Yes.
And, you know, they have over 50 tracks of litigation. One of my favorite, Rafe lawyers, just sued with CHD's help the national parks for denying people access for who wanted to pay with cash.
Yep.
So culture matters and influences the decisions that the courts make.
Yep.
And, you know, when you first started to talk to me about how we have to save and preserve the culture, I didn't understand what you meant. And now I do. It took me years to kind of understand it and see it. And
well, the biggest part of that owning the culture for me is you've got to understand what's been happening in the churches, how they've been cored out and hollowed out from inside. Because whether we like it or not, that's what is at the center of this culture.
It is so frightening to me.
Yes.
How the churches have been kowtowed.
They've been infiltrated and hollowed out.
Right.
They have been infiltrated and hollowed out. And it was a very deliberate operation. I know, I've written 4-volume tome about this hollowing out operation. And the problem that people have to understand is that without that check in the culture, the Enlightenment part of the culture has run amok. And that's why we're at where we're at today. It's without that check.
Right. And we need Enlightenment.
We do.
We need it. And we need it.
But on its own, it produces this situation that we're in. This is the problem. So, you know, I could go on, but my real hope is that people will pick up that 4-volume tome and read it. They may not agree with it, but at least it will, I think, get them to start to understand how deep these issues really are and how widespread and how far back they go.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the crucial thing. And I don't think that it's yet sunk into many people how problematic the situation really is. There's a reason that the principal player on the global stage that is not going along with Mr. Globaloney is Russia. There's a reason for that.
Right.
There is a reason for that. And it's a very different Russia than the Soviet Union that we're dealing with. And until we understand that, we're not gonna get anywhere. So anyway.
Well, but isn't that a message for, you know, for our moving forward to how do we access that enlightenment and nurture it and grow it in our individual and lives and in our families and our communities?
Understand that the principal problems are theological. Understand that the principal problems are philosophical. They're not legal, they're not political, they're not financial, they're not economic, they're not scientific.
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the things we talked about on the Salieri Report in the first quarter is what I call the Paul O'Neill problem. Mm-hmm. Paul O'Neill was the guy who turned around Ocoa, and it's a wonderful story because it shows someone who takes a very strong value position, and it's from mm-hmm. those values mm-hmm. That the culture rejuvenates and the
right
and the company rejuvenates and then the profits rejuvenate.
We have to have a restoration of virtues. That's what we have to have.
And that's what he did at Alcoa. Yes. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times during the litigation I would take a position. Essentially, and it was funny because I've memorized a fair amount of scripture, and mm-hmm. it's these moments when you're pressed and have to make a snap decision that a scripture will come into your head.
Right.
Or it doesn't into my head.
Right.
And then I know what to do.
Right.
And I would just say, well, and the attorneys would say, but you don't understand. You have no choice. You have to go along. And I would say, no, I don't.
No, I don't.
I don't have to go along. No. And I'm going to stand on this principle. Right. And if you don't like it, shoot me, kill me. I quit.
Do something. Yeah. Right.
Do something.
Exactly.
There was a moment I've told you about when the attorney said, well, if you don't do this, the insurance company will drop your representation and then you'll go to prison. And I just laughed and I looked at them and I said, you know something? Gandhi went to prison.
Right.
Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, they went to prison. Right. If I'm going to prison, then it's because this government will fall. And right. I need to go to prison. God wants me to go to prison to organize the last entrepreneurs I need to run this country when the government falls.
Right.
So, you know, and what I didn't realize at that point, what they were threatening was illegal. It is illegal for an insurance company to threaten, you know, to pull your insurance, to bully you into a position. And I said, you know, so if you got a problem with that, tough.
Tough.
And yeah, tough.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is the attorney told me several months later that that was when he realized that we could win.
Yep.
And I said, so you ordered me to do something that if I did, it would convince you we're going to lose. Yep. Why would you do that? Yeah. Why would you do that? But every time I've ever stood on one of those, you know, I call it the Gestalt thing, a miracle happens. And what you discover right. is the options, you know, that had you cornered were those options until you said, no, I'm not going along. I'm going to stand. This is unacceptable. And suddenly new options appear because you took that stand.
Yeah.
And if you want miracles in your life to happen, then you have to have the faith and you have to be prepared to take the consequences if you're wrong. So, I'm with you. You, until you come to understand that we are part of the creation and we have a responsibility as to what we create.
Yep.
Yep. So, you know, and the plasma is waiting for instructions. Right?
Well, some of it may be, yes. Others of it may be the instruction issuers, but
yes, who knows?
That's another topic.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that when we talk about the moon, Joseph. Anything else you want to say before we close up?
No, that's it.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for part two of the first quarter wrap up. Please check out the website and all the resources that are available. And again, thank you for joining us on the Salaire Report. And thank you to Dr. Joseph Farrell and to Shiloh, who's been very quiet.
She's now over by the door saying, take me outside now. So thanks for having me back on, Catherine.
Thank you, Joseph. Bye.
Bye-bye.